This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodling? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed. Mm-hmm.
Sharon Lawson Bram, skidamarinky-dinky-dink.
Yeah.
Skidamarinky-doo.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pie. Watch your mouth, you scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much, you, who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts, and we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Just Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening. And yes, we are back in business on the Place to Be podcast. It has been quite a while. And of course, joining me as always, the man who's as big as an elephant and as fast as a deer. Well, perhaps a dead deer. And that is my PIC, Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Yeah, that guy. What he's heckling. Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be.
I've been saving that since the Hall of Fame when they said that in the Haystack Calhoun video package. had that loaded up since then.
Oh, God. JR, always a pleasure. Welcome, Place to Be Nation, to the 3-4s, baby, 4-4-4 of the Place to Be podcast and the mothership. And, yeah, it's the first time I've talked to you since you've returned from the big week. Did you have a good time down there? You did a little of everything. So
yeah, a lot of everything. I am still recovering. But before we get to that, because the man you hear cackling as we're talking is our special guest tonight. We're gonna bring him in because he was a big part of the weekend.
Yes.
So I thought we could take a few minutes to talk about that. And that is, of course, one and only. He is formerly of the Titans of Wrestling, currently of This Week in Wrestling, and of course also the Space City podcast, looking at Houston and NBA Classics. And you hear him as an oft correspondent on Clotheslines and Headlines. That is my good friend, Mr. Pete Schermacher. Pete, how are you, sir?
Doing fantastic. How's everyone doing?
Good. That's excellent. It's nice to have you on, Pete. This is actually the second podcast you and I have ever been on together.
This is true.
Yes, you and I actually, way back in the day, you and I did a pro wrestling super show with Mr. Stephen Graham. Do you remember what
That is true. We
know what it was?
Chris Jericho, right?
Correct. The Chris Jericho snapshot. Very good.
Much better host this time around, Pete.
Yeah, definitely. There's no doubt about that.
No doubt.
Anyway, Pete, it's good to have you on. It's nice to have you.
Thanks. Thank you.
Pete and I got as close as two men could get in Orlando at WrestleMania.
Yeah, pretty evident.
It was wonderful. Yep. It was wonderful. Yeah, it was a busy week. It started, I actually flew to Arizona for a day for work. And I swear I still have not recovered from like that time change and everything. And then went right to Orlando on a red eye. And your buddy JT here does not sleep well on planes. So I did not really sleep. I was up from Thursday morning until the wee hours of Saturday morning straight through. Through the Hall of Fame, through WrestleCon, through what else did we do? The Superstore visit. And then out on the bars, out on the streets of Orlando, was a ruckus good time. It was like Mardi Gras down there for those couple nights. Just madness on the local streets. And then Saturday, the cowboy and I took the wives to Universal Studios. We did that, rode all the rides. It was pretty awesome not having kids with us. We went through all the single rider lines, so we hit everything. And nice. Had a good time, had a nice dinner. And then Sunday was the big day. That's where I saw Pete. Yep. We had the big tailgate in an abandoned lot about 5 minutes away from the Citrus Bowl. Pete, tell him.
Chief, one minute away from Hobo Alley.
Right. Tell everyone about the setup for this thing, right? It was interesting.
Yeah, I got dropped off by an Uber, and I'm like, I had no idea where it really was, so I just see people drinking in this baseball field. So I assume that's all you clowns. And it wasn't. It was a bunch of other clowns. And then I went down Hobo Alley and got asked for money about five times. And then I found our spot right on the corner of Hobo Alley, which is probably where normally people would be pulling tricks. The hookers normally would be pulling tricks, I would assume. I'm sure Nick had to clear out a couple dead bodies off the alley or people sleeping there for us to set up for him to
I think they're in the back of his van, probably. That's my guess. Yeah, it was an interesting setup. But, you know, we made friends. We passed out some extra food and drink to the locals. We took care of the security guy. We were filling him up beers and red cups. He's our photographer, videographer, Kel. If anyone needs one in Orlando, let me know. I have his number. Took our group photo as well. But no, no one really hassled us. It was a good time. We were graced by the presence of Brad Stutzy and his crew, and Grant Sawyer, the boys from CWF. I think we topped out around 30 guys, Pete.
It was a good turnout.
Yeah, and a lot of food, and of course, I think it's the most drunk my wife has gotten in years. I mean, she was knocking back fireball shots. So I mean, it was
wow.
It was quite the show. Jello shots were flowing freely, and it was a great time, great tailgate. And of course, we walked over to the Citrus Bowl, Camping World Arena. And Camaro Stadium, I should say, and had a great time there. I nestled in next to Pete for 7 hours, and we had a great time. It was, it was, of course, well, I guess we'll dive into the show on Wednesday night and close in headlines in detail. And Scott, I know you covered a main event, but live, it was an awesome experience. The weather was phenomenal, especially once the sun went down. The first hour or so was a little harrowing, but by the time the proper show started and the sun was down, we had a nice breeze and the atmosphere. I mean, just the crowd was so
pumped.
Yeah, pumped and happy. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't that typical smarky mania crowd we've gotten used to. It was very fun-filled. I don't know. Maybe it was just the theme park atmosphere or what, but it was really cool. And the Hardys thing was probably a top three live moment for me to have seen Pete. Does it rank pretty high for you live?
It was really awesome, and the pop the crowd gave for him was just incredible. I probably have that in my top. Yeah, 5 or 10 moments of my life, because I mean, I went to a lot of 80s wrestling. Like, I've seen this. I was live at Steamboat, Ric Flair title change in Chicago. So that's for me as a Steamboat fan, that was like number one. I had some great memories in Houston growing up, but yeah, this was being live there. That was something special, and because I really thought they were going to come back and they were going to push them as the delete characters, and I was obviously nuts to think that, because it's WWE and they like their ideas usually stick. And yeah, but what the whole entire and then winning the titles there, it was just a great feel-good moment.
I love the way they brought the crowd up and then back down and then up, because the New Day comes out and you're kind of thinking maybe the Hardys, but then it kind of seemed like it was just gonna be the New Day, and then bang, here come the Hardys, and the place just went ape shit. I mean, I put it up there with I think I mentioned this in our group chat, I put it up there with Foley winning the title on that '99 Raw. That's probably the loudest I've ever heard a building, and I think the only reason that topped the Hardys was because it's a closed building, so it was just louder and it was shaking. Scott Steiner's debut at Survivor Series 02, and then this, like, those are my top three, I think, loudest pops I've ever experienced. It was just craziness. But anyway, it was a great time. If anyone out there is planning to go to New Orleans, let us know. We're debating right now. Nick Duke tells us it's a better bar crawl city than it is a tailgate city, so we'll talk that out over the next year. But we are planning to be there in force. Nick's already organizing things, so I'll be booking my hotel soon just to get it on the books, Pete.
I hear you, man. I one thing about New Orleans, though, that's an expensive town, man.
It is.
I've never seen more expensive for a beer at a bar, like $9 or something. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Wow.
Make sure you bring some coin if you're going to be on Bourbon Street, because they gouge the tourists, I'll tell you that much.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
So am I.
I've never been to New Orleans, so I'm really pumped. So we'll talk more about that, of course, over the coming year, I'm sure, Pete. But why don't we turn our attention tonight, Scott, to our topic on hand.
Indeed, as we spent the last couple of shows, JR, out of our office. We were in Chicago, and we were at the Meadowlands. So now we are back home. We're in the home office. We're in our offices up in the suite level at Madison Square Garden for another fine live event brought to you by the World Wrestling Federation. So why don't we dive in? The date is November 25th. 1985, live from Madison Square Garden in New York City. Let's take a look at the crowd. What do you got for a crowd there, JR?
Let's see. Graham has 16,000.
Okay, which is about the regular house. I don't, that doesn't sound like the Felt Forum was used on that night, because 16,000. Right.
Yeah, without Hulk being on there, you know, because he is the ace draw. But having Andre, you know, you think you might pop a crowd a little bit.
And, of course, this is also 3 days before Thanksgiving.
Exactly, which is why it's actually going to be a very light sports day as well. We'll get to that a little bit later on. Okay. Your announcer is just Gorilla Monsoon for the beginning, but then he'll be joined by his color commentator about halfway through, well, a little less than halfway through the show. JR, give us our honor roll.
Hulk Hogan, 672 days into his reign. Tito Santana, 142 days into his reign as Intercontinental Champion. The Dream Team at 93 days as tag champs. And Wendy Richter, 239 days into her reign as women's champion. And one other note for Mr. Sutton here, of course. I think we covered this last month, but Rick McGraw passed away on November 1st. Suffering
we did.
From a heart attack.
Yep, we did.
So we covered that in detail. Mr. Yep. Jarvis has some notes as well of things that have happened since our last chat on October 21st here at MSG. On the 1026 episode of Championship Wrestling, Rick McGraw was guest on Piper's Pit. During the segment, Piper indicated that as a change of pace, he would showcase mediocre wrestlers on the show. This riled up McGraw, who snatched the mic and made fun of Piper for wearing a dress. He also called Piper a coward for not wrestling on TV. Piper asked if this was a challenge, and McGraw replied that he will give Piper a week to think about it before slapping him as he left the set. Piper accepted the challenge and wrestled McGraw on a TV match that would air on November 2nd, recorded on October 25th from Poughkeepsie. Unfortunately, of course, McGraw died of a heart attack on November 1st, one day before the match aired. In cruel irony, at the end of the match, which Piper won after ref stoppage, Bruno Sammartino on commentary made the comment that he was glad the referee stopped the match to save McGraw for another day. I can't believe they didn't edit that or change it.
Get rid of them. Forget it, never happened.
On the 11-2 Championship Wrestling, the classic turnbuckle pad with the WWF logo made their first appearance. The wrestling album was released by the WWF in early 1985. In the 11-9 issue of Rolling Stone, they provided a very brief synopsis of the album, concluding with the sentence, "As singers, they're pretty good wrestlers." So there you go. And as discussed previously in the Vintage Vault, on the 11-22 Philadelphia Spectrum show, Ron Shaw defeated David Sammartino in what has been called a phantom submission match. David would leave the company shortly after this. So took his big booty home, and that was it for David Sammartino.
That's it. No more booty. No more booty. All right. And I just want to confirm that Science Minute we were at JR was, of course, in Hershey, the big fat slop pig. And, of course, we were in Chicago for the Wrestling Classic. Of course, the tournament was won by the Junkyard Dog. And now here we are back in our haunt at Madison Square Garden. All right, let's dive into our opener. And we open with a debut, JR, a newcomer to the scene. And who is it?
That newcomer, Scott and Pete, is Danny Spivey. Born in Tampa, Florida in 1952, he attended the University of Georgia, played for the Bulldogs as a defensive end. He looked to have a future in pro football, having been drafted by your New York Jets, Scott, before his junior year. However, a severe knee injury that year ended his football career. After college, Spivey met Dusty Rhodes while in Tampa and persuaded to try professional wrestling as a career. Began training with Rhodes in 1983 and made his debut that year in Championship Wrestling from Florida. During his time in the CWF, he teamed with Scott Hall as part of the tag team American Starship. In the mid-80s, Spivey worked in the Mid-Atlantic and Kansas City territories with little success before joining on in the WWF in late 85. Pete, any thoughts on Spivey before we get into the match, just like on his pre-WWF career? Any familiarity with it?
pretty much the only thing I really remember him from is like WCW in the center stage, or not center stage, but Crockett territory, where he was kind of working as an underneath big guy. He had like a fun 6-man tag against the Horsemen at one point, and we nominated it as like a low level nomination for the Death Valley Driver Best of the 80s Crockett set that Zellner and I are working on right now. But you know, you look at him, he looks like a million bucks. He looks like a miniature, looks like Hulk Hogan and almost, especially here with the yellow tights and the yellow hair, and even throws a leg drop. But I don't, you just look at him, but he looks like a guy who should have been bigger than he really was. And I guess he really didn't get over to the most extreme until he became like part of the Twin Towers. And he was known as the worker of the team with Sid at the time.
The skyscrapers, then, you mean?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Skyscrapers. I'm sorry. Did I say Twin Towers? Yeah, I meant skyscrapers. And then eventually, you know, he does the Wailing Mercy gimmick, but he really got most of his successes was in Japan. But you look at him, and he looks like a guy who, by look, should have drawn some serious money back in the day.
Agreed. He has a great look, and I'll talk about it here. So he is taking on our old friend Terry Gibbs to open up the show. And, of course, Gorilla Monsoon is solo for right now. Disappointing after we had Jesse for two shows, but we'll see how long that disappointment lasts. Gorilla puts over Spivey's size, and he looks as Gibbs does his usual heel routine before the bout. Spivey takes control off the bell and keeps Gibbs reeling before going to work on the arm. Gorilla knows that Spivey was a former NFL player drafted by the Jets. The big man keeps yanking on the arm. Gorilla also notes that many competitors in the WWF are looking at potential tag partners to challenge the Dream Team, so Spivey could be a prime candidate. Gibbs levies some forearms to break free, but Spivey reverses a whip and goes to the arm with a couple of different submission holds. Gorilla discusses the recently released wrestling album as the crowd chants boring. Gibbs catches Spivey coming in and rattles him with an atomic drop and a backbreaker before shoving Spivey to the floor. Spivey pulls himself back up, but Gibbs meets him and runs him into the corner and then shoves him back to the floor. Spivey comes back and tries for a sunset flip, but Gibbs blocks it with a right hand to the face, followed by an elbow drop and a lazy cover for two. Gibbs goes to a bear hug. Spivey breaks free, but Dandy drops his head on a whip and Gibbs boots him in the face. Gibbs gets a neck breaker for two, but wastes time jawing with the crowd before the cover. Gibbs goes back to bear hug as Gorilla lets us know that Jesse Ventura is prepping for his match, but after that, he'll join us in the booth. Spivey powers out of the hold with a hip lock, but whiffs on an elbow drop. Gibbs takes Spivey over with a backdrop for two, but Gorilla continues to criticize Gibbs' pin attempts. Spivey gets a bear hug of his own, but Gibbs goes to the eyes. Spivey recovers and runs Gibbs to the buckle, and then hip toss and slams him down before connecting on an elbow drop for two. Spivey follows a big leg drop for another near fall and then finishes things with a bulldog. And that bulldog kind of reminds me of another guy, Scott. Tall, lanky, young, blonde, I don't know who. Match was okay, but bland and choppy. Spivey was okay, but very green, you could tell. And Gibbs looked good as always, consummate heel veteran, gets the job done. I went a half a star on this one, Scott.
I went a half, I went a half star as well. A couple things. I was surprised he was actually, it's funny you mentioned this, Pete. I was actually kind of surprised that he was allowed to wear yellow, to be honest with you. Maybe the yellow pads.
Right.
Although 85, don't forget, Hogan was still doing the rotation. He still had the white. He wore sometimes the super alternate AWA blue. So he was, he wasn't locked into yellow and red really yet. Probably.
I was actually comparing him to Barry Windham. Okay.
Barry Windham. No, yeah. I know you were comparing the move to Barry Windham. I'm saying the tights part.
Okay.
The bulldog. Oh, no doubt. I mean, the hair was long enough. It was Windham plus like probably 70 pounds. No doubt in the work rate department. But I'm just saying that I'm surprised they let Spivey wear yellow. But then again, like I said, Hogan was still kind of rotating between the white and the alternate AWA blue, so he really didn't lock into yellow and red probably till mid-86. That was a decent little power opener. I mean, it wasn't anything offensive, but you could tell Spivey was still kind of, you know, getting his way through things. Because honestly, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts, Pete, you know, even as a jobber in Crockett, you work differently than you do as a jobber or an upper mid-card guy, lower mid-card guy in WWF. They just work their matches differently. And Gorilla alone, it's tough because Gorilla is a straight man to a comedy guy or to a effort, you know, kind of a more charismatic guy. So when you just have the straight guy by himself, it's a little rough. So not exactly the prime spot for Gorilla. However, in this specific match, it was probably okay because there really wasn't any characters or ongoing storylines where having Jesse would have been better, to be honest with you. I don't know what Jesse would have added with, I mean, he wasn't going to really make fun of Spivey, I suppose, but it depends. When it's not a really invested heel, Jesse usually kind of vamps and just kind of plays it straight. So even with Jesse there, the match in terms of, you know, the feeling and tone probably wouldn't have changed. So I gave it a half star as well. What do you think, Pete?
Yeah, I went 3/4 of a star. I thought the storyline was pretty fine with Spivey working the arm, and then you got it over where you can follow the narrative pretty easily. But I thought it was booked all wrong, where you thought Spivey should come in and guzzle the hell out of him because it's Terry Gibbs, and you want to get Spivey off hot. And here he kind of went more 50-50-ish, which is kind of like a WWE trope. But I was more shocked that he actually dropped the Hulkster's leg drop and only gets the 2 count out of it. So WWF at the time was, and they still are real protective of people's finishers. So either, and you know, back in the day, they didn't have agents back there and they're calling it on the fly. So I'm sure he got a big earful for using the Hulkster's finisher and getting a 2 count out of it. Or that was a message to the Hulk to shape up. We could replace you with him, which I don't know. I think this is more of Spivey's greenness showing up and not knowing the protocols of locker room etiquette and people's finishers. But I thought it was a capable opener, and I thought Gibbs looked really good trying to make Spivey.
I'm so glad that we have now added "guzzle the hell out of him" into our Place to Be Nation, into our Place to Be Nation Hall of Fame vernacular. I think when we do the next open, we'll have like Deontay or Jordan Duncan, Akiyama, guzzle the hell out of him. Fantastic.
Well done, Pete. Gibbs has been a bit of a revelation for me watching these. He's a really good heel, steady heel job guy. You know, like you said, Pete, just kind of knows what he's doing and helps make the younger guys look good. And I thought the first couple of matches, Scott, that we watched with him, he wasn't. I don't know. He maybe uses off nights, but the last few we've seen, I thought he's been really good. I've enjoyed him every time.
He's a solid jobber, solid heel guy, you know, jaw jacking in Spivey's face. And I think he's been really good. And he's a solid opener guy. I think we gotta look back, JR, but I think he's opened like, what is this, like our 10th probably house show of the year or 9th house show of the year? And I think he's opened like 6 of them, probably.
Yeah, there's been a few.
So he settled in a pretty good spot here. So I think it works fine, and I think he did a good job. And let me see, our official time, according to Mr. Cawthon, was 10:10, which might have been a bit much, but I think from there, I think you're going to see a lot of that tonight in terms of match lengths. I think you're going to see some kind of interesting layouts in terms of the format tonight. So anyway, there you go. Dan Spivey gets his first big garden win since joining the World Wrestling Federation in a win over Terry Gibbs. Next up, JR, we have yet another debut, mm-hmm. and one that actually ends up being a very enduring character both in this company and in professional wrestling for, the good next almost 15, 20 years. Who do we got?
Daniel Marsh began his wrestling career working for the WWF in 1981 as a referee. He worked under the ring name Danny Davis. In early 1985, he worked as a jobber in matches under a mask, so the audience would not be able to tell he was also a ref. During this period, he wrestled as Mr. X under the mask.
Mr. X. Why did his weight have to be unknown? I understand, you know.
He's not around a scale.
Parts unknown. Well, you know.
No scales around.
Weight unknown. So. And so there you go. There's Mr. X, and who's he taking on tonight, Jared?
He's battling the Tonga Kid, who we saw on our last MSG show in a not-so-impressive match with Ron Shaw.
You mean King Tonga?
King Tonga, yes, when I say Tonga. King Tonga.
Tonga Kid. He's already gone.
So, King Tonga's back this month, hopefully with a better showing. Gorilla says, parts are known as a small town in southwest Texas. Tonga's thick as hell, as well, which I noticed. We start with a lockup and some arm work by Mr. X, but Tonga just powers out of it and hoists X onto the top buckle to show his strength. Tonga levels X with a chop, but X comes back with a side headlock. Gorilla wonders how you can get so big in Tonga when you only eat coconuts and bananas. So, good old casual 1985 racism. Tonga again sits X on the top rope to break a hold, messing with him a bit more. X goes to the back to the side headlock, but Tonga turns into a side wrist lock. X goes to the hair and then kicks away, but Tonga just shoves him down and buries him with a thrust kick. X begs off, and Tonga flips him over and goes to a trapezius hold. Tonga maintains control, working Mr. X over and going back to the trap. Mr. X tries to work out of the hold until Tonga releases and slams him, but X dodges a splash and then goes to work with some weak flailing offense. X grabs a rear chin lock and drops a leg for two before going back to the hold. Tonga fights free, but Mr. X catches him with a knee and then goes to a chin lock again. Tonga tries another comeback. X dodges the charge in the corner and then runs Tonga to the buckle, but Tonga no-sells it and rams his own head a few times to fire himself up. Mr. X begs off and goes to the eyes, but Tonga fights through it, crushes Mr. X with a headbutt, followed by an inverted atomic drop. X then leapfrogs the ducking Tonga, but jumps right up into a nice thrust kick, and Tonga drops a diving headbutt to pick up the win. I thought this was better than last time, but still choppy and kind of weird. X's offense is so soft and awkward, and he got way too much of it. Tonga should not be selling for these guys. He should be mowing these guys down. Sluggish pace overall. But, you know, Tonga looked okay. Just he didn't get enough offense, and X's offense was terrible. I went a half a star here, Pete. What'd you have?
Yeah, I went half a star, too. And it's funny, I did not know it was Danny Davis who Mr. X was. But the whole entire time, I'm, like, trying to figure out who it is. And I did deduce that it was Danny Davis, which means I watched way too much wrestling if I'm able to pick up on his fingerprints on his wrestling skill set, which is terrifying. But, yeah, I'm with you. Again, I'm going to say it. King Tonga should have guzzled the shit out of him instead of this almost like 50-50 match. But again, that's WWF undercard style. It's they like to get these people in buying. They want to get their concessions. They want people drinking their beer, their sodas, their hot dogs. And they make these openers go a little long. And that's what we got here instead of how it should have been for business going forward. They're more in the moment instead of looking at the future.
Well, we could have King Tonga just beat him up for 10 minutes. You know, like, I mean, that would have worked. He was guzzling him like Pete drinking a Stella at the tailgate. He was guzzling him. what do you think, Scott?
Your official time of this match is 8:48, and I think I figured out what our first whenever we finally get our store at ProWrestlingTees.com, I think we know what our first shirt's going to be. It's going to be a shadow of Pete's head with guzzle to shit. So, a big debut here for Mr. X, and you know another match for King Tonga, who we hope can kind of get himself into a groove here with some better opponents. Again, Gorilla by himself, even here now, this is a match where we probably could have used a little spice from Jesse. And it wasn't there. And again, you know, the casual racism.
I say Gorilla filled in for Jesse with the racist comments. That was
with a racist comment of banana.
He stepped in.
Yep. Pretty much standard house show fare. I also gave it. I also gave it a half star. I can't really. I mean, it's again typical standard fare. Crowd was. Crowd had a buzz in it though, and I think as they get better stuff as the show progresses, you'll hear them. You could tell there's a specific fall buzz in the air. Fall into winter, of course, as you mentioned, JR, we're a couple days away from Turkey Day. So you could tell that they want to bust out, but these first two matches didn't let them, in my opinion. So I gave it a half star. So King Tonga gets the win in his second appearance at the Garden. Again, your match length was 8:48. Incidentally, before we continue, we have to talk about the other show going on this evening. And being in November, of course, I guarantee you Vince was not here at the Garden. I'm sure somebody else was. Because he was at the other show. Yeah, he was probably at the other show, which was at the auditorium in West Palm Beach, Florida. And you know Vince. He's probably like, you know, Pat, take care of this, or Arnie Skoland. I'm going down to Florida, pal. Here's your card. Jim Young pinned Rusty Brooks. Need some Jim Young there, Pete. Jose Luis Rivera pinned Joe Murto. I think we're even on the two shows so far. After these right. Two matches.
We have him with star power right now.
I know, yeah. Scotty McGee pinned Moondog Spot. Scotty vs. Spotty. Paul Orndorff pinned defeated Randy Savage via disqualification. Cowboy Bob Orton beat Mike Rotundo. The Hart Foundation defeated Tony Atlas and Lanny Poffo. And in your main event, it was Hulk Hogan defeated Roddy Piper via countout. So there was the card also going on this evening at down in West Palm Beach, Florida.
I wonder if Trump flew down for that one, too.
Exactly. let us go next. And finally, JR, maybe we'll get our color commentator back because he's up next, continuing this one-month feud. Break it down.
He is. Jesse Ventura battling the illustrious Barry O. Of course, this is the big payoff to their tussle from last month of the big challenge. When O got thrown onto the announce table and Jesse got pissed off, and then they started shoving and jawing at each other. Kind of a cool rare shot where Jesse's basically working as a face here. Kind of a special moment for him and the fans. Gorilla calls out Barrio's heavily taped hand and puts over how great Jesse looks as we get going. Jesse preens a bit to a pop, and then we get a lockup and some arm work from both guys, reversing holds. And the match resets as Barry grabs a standing wrist lock, but Gorilla says that won't work thanks to Jesse's height advantage. And he's right, as Jesse easily shoves him down and then poses. Barry buries a knee and climbs away, working in some right hands, kicks and elbows, and picking up a near fall. Jesse selling and bumping is as awkward as ever, I will say that, despite his good look. Barry ended up on the floor after Jesse kick out, but Jesse won't let him back in the ring, just kicking away whenever he tries to climb in. Jesse struts and lets Barry get back up on the apron just to elbow and shove him back outside again. Barry punches his way back in, eventually clotheslining Jesse's neck across the top rope. Barry comes off the top with an elbow to the shoulder for two and then goes to a chin lock. Jesse powers up and shoves Barry down, but Barry goes to the eyes and back to the chin lock, taunting Jesse as he does it. Jesse works free again and plants Barry with a pair of shoulder blocks, but Barry catches him with a knee to the gut, followed by some punches to the breadbasket and right back to the chin lock. Jesse punches free and goes to the eyes, and then a thrust to the throat. Jesse clubs and kicks away and drags the eyes across the top rope. Barry stumbles around blindly, and Jesse plugs him in the eyes another time, and then follows in an inverted atomic drop. Barry comes back again with some strikes and a clothesline, and the two collide heads. Barry recovers first and drills Jesse with some right hands. Jesse dodges a dropkick and then lands a stiff knee to the lower back, followed by the old hanging backbreaker for the submission win. This is about what you would expect. It's filled with strikes and chin locks, but the crowd was really into Jesse. And the end was fine, even though most of it was bland. It was just a mix of awkward selling and bumping by both guys, and just not the best mix. But still a pretty fun moment for Jesse, getting to see him work this match as a face. Again, you know, I like Barrio enough, but these two just didn't mix. And the bumping by both is not great. So I went a half a star, Scott, again on this one.
I'll admit I was a little generous. I gave it a star, just for Jesse's Jesse's appearance and his, you know, it was kind of a mixed reaction, and Grill acknowledged it that he got a mixed reaction, but yeah, it's evident that Jesse is very, hesitant about bumping anymore. So it was probably smart that for the most part, his in-ring career ended here. Obviously, he's a little nervous about falling and bumping, so he kind of tiptoed his way through it, and I think that's what ultimately happened. I give it a star because I kind of thought it was going to be a squash. I thought Jesse was going to boot him in the gut and give him a torture rack and end it, to be honest with you. So I got to give Barrio a little credit. They actually kind of gave him, you know, they gave him a little bit more offense than I thought they would. Your official time is 10:21, which is much longer than this probably should have been. But credit to Barrio, he got to show a little offense in a match that I really thought should have been a squash. Yeah, that's about all I got. But I'll give it a star. What about you, Pete?
Yeah, I went half a star. And I'm a guy. I like Barrio when I've seen him work. He actually over in Houston, he's worked underneath too, and he's been pretty cute. They've been a lot more competitive matches, and he's been really good in them. But here, yeah, this was pretty bad. My favorite part of the match started early with Ventura actually grabbing Barrio's hand and rakes it burns it on the top of the rope, which is a spot I'm surprised more wrestlers don't do today, since they're big on the new – on the indie scene, they're big on the pretending they're breaking the fingers gimmick or manipulating the digits. And, I mean, I think a perfect thing would, after you snap the finger, would be to grab it and then burn it on top of the rope. But they don't do that spot, which I think surprises me. But after that spot, it went downhill from there with it getting awkward and the bumping. I thought, though, with the hand rake thing, I thought Ventura looked really nasty right off the bat. I'm like, oh, man, this is a different Jesse Ventura than I'm expecting. And
right.
But then he fell back into suit of typical Jesse, but as a baby face. Yeah, half star.
Okay.
I'm going to manipulate your digits, Scott.
I have no problem with it. I was given, like, the extra star for Barrio. Extra star for Barrio. Jesse's Jesse. But my only thing was it definitely didn't need to be 10:21. That's for sure. Guess what, JR? Another debut in our next match here. Another debut. What do we got? Another. Against the guy that you're hoping gets squashed in the debut.
Oh, yeah. Another charming debut. All right. So here we go. Raymond Hernandez began his wrestling career in 1981, primarily working in Florida and Texas under the name Hercules Hernandez. In 1982, he moved on to the Central States territory in Kansas City, where he'd win the NWA Central States tag titles twice with partner Dewey Robertson, of course, also known as the Missing Link. He would also win the Central States TV title, hold it over 6 months. Hernandez was getting notoriously notoriety after a feud with former world champion Harley Race. In 1983, he would wrestle in the Jim Crockett territories. The Masked Assassin 2 would take part in the inaugural Starrcade. Moved on to Mid-South in 1984, continued to wear a mask as Mr. Wrestling 3 before unmasking and continuing on as Hercules Hernandez. Would join Skandor Akbar stable, Devastation Inc., along with Ted DiBiase. In his return to Florida, quickly won the NWA Florida Southern Heavyweight title, and shortly after, the NWA Florida Heavyweight title. His reigns would be short, as he was fired from the promotion and stripped of his titles in July 85 after a backstage fight with Wahoo McDaniel. After a short run in Puerto Rico, Hernandez signed on with the WWF in November of 85. Pete, any thoughts on Hercules prior to this run?
I'm assuming Wahoo just whooped his ass, for starters. But I've seen him in Houston and in Mid-South and in World Class and of course, the Starrcade match. He was actually pretty competent as Mr. Wrestling 3, and him and Mr. Wrestling 2 had a really fun feud over in and actually been over in Houston on the NWA On Demand, and he's also had really good matches with Magnum TA, doing a Mr. Wrestling 3 versus Magnum TA feud that really worked also, and he showed promise. And he's one of those guys who has kind of has that bad rap of not being a good wrestler, but I've seen him have good matches. I don't want to say he's a good wrestler because that's a lie, but I've seen him have good matches with Steamboat and Kurt Hennig and, like I said, Magnum TA, Mr. Wrestling 2. I've seen him be fine in tag matches, and then later on I enjoyed his run as in Power and Glory, but yeah, but it was weird underneath, and then, of course, he became the Super Invader later on in WCW. But yeah, he's a guy who was a solid worker, but he didn't have the charisma, and he probably, being under the mask, probably helped him because he had a really good body, but his face was kind of ugly. But he was solid worker. You know, he's a guy on the card. He might have a good match, might not. You never know. He was kind of a hit or miss type of wrestler.
And a wrestler's all miss is his opponent here tonight, his cousin Junior. Lanny Neal Keen Jr. began wrestling in Kentucky in 1983 under the name Luscious Lanny Keen. My lord. Very varying definitions of luscious. In 1984, he moved on to the WWF, where he was a jobber before being brought into the Hillbilly Family Stable with Hillbilly Jim, given the name Cousin Junior. Role model after the TV character Jethro Bodine from the Beverly Hillbillies. Keen would continue the role into 1986 before leaving for the independent circuits. During his career, he'd win the AWA Southern Tag Team titles with the Giant Hillbilly and USWA Tag Team championships 4 times, twice with Moondog Spot, twice with Moondog Spike. Passed away in January of 2009 from a heart attack at the age of 46. A lot of grits, I'm guessing.
Wow.
Herc, the new heel in town.
I thought you were going to say, Cousin Junior started his career about 2 minutes before this match started.
God, I'd feel better if he did, honestly. Make more sense. Hercules' new heel, managed by Freddie Blassie, gets the luxury of battling Cousin Junior. He gets a full entrance and a fucking pop, sadly. That MSG love these goddamn hillbillies. They're like, every time they get a huge pop. Junior has his dumb hat on and does his asinine jig as Herc and Blassie just stare at him. Gorilla notes that a lot of greats are coming out of Tampa these days and puts over Herc's physique. We open with a lockup and a stalemate before Herc uses his power to take Junior down and keep him there. Herc continues to batter Junior and even fights off a comeback by burying a kick to Junior's chin on a charge. Gorilla says a hush has gone over the crowd as Herc grabs a chin lock. Hercules releases and drops an elbow for two before going back to the chin lock. Junior would get out of the hold, but Herc yanks him to the floor by the overalls, where the hillbilly gets berated by Blassie. Herc goes to the eyes and slugs away to keep Junior outside the ring. Junior finds an opening and tries for a sunset flip on his way back in, but Herc blocked that with a right hand. Herc lays in a blow for two and goes to the chinlock as Gorilla chastises the pin covers. The chinlocks continue on and on and on until Junior finally fires up and hammers away. Herc cuts him off with a kick, an awkward shoulder block followed by a slam. Herc heads up top, but Junior dodges his dive and starts in with some offense with a backdrop. Herc tries for a power slam, but Junior slips behind him and botches a roll-up, so they reset and try another roll-up, and they fuck that up too. Blassie gets on the apron to distract the ref, and Herc rolls onto Junior for the win. I thought this was brutal. I think this match would make you question if you ever really loved wrestling and why. I think it's one of the worst finishes I've ever seen. It was botched across the board. Hercules is really green, it seemed here, and showed a flash or two, but Junior's fucking awful. He didn't help at all, and this is slop. And again, if this was the first match I ever saw, I may never have come back to wrestling. Like, that's how fucking awful this was. We don't do negatives here, so dud all the way, but it would be like a negative 6-star Dave Meltzer special in my mind. This was, I think, Scott, this may be the worst match we've watched in this reboot in 85. Pete, what did you think of this fucking debacle?
I give it a dud. Way too long. It was god-awful. Just shoot, bowling shoe ugly, as Jim Ross would say. It was terrible. I mean, I can't even put into words how terrible it is. It makes me miss Sergeant Rene Goulet here. I mean, I just don't understand putting Cousin Jr. in against with a heel who has a decent look, who has potential. You have him with Blassie, who has a lot of cachet in the territory, and you open him up as his debut against Cousin Jr., who you know is not going to make him look good. And it means nothing because everyone beats Cousin Jr. So it was, you might as well put him up against a jobber who might make him look respectable. This was just garbage.
Big time.
Well, at least we have a new, we'll be changing the Drizzler later on. call it the Cousin Jr. Award.
The Jr., yeah.
I gave it a dud. This is fucking brutal. This match was 11:33. Who in their right mind thought anything would come good out of 11 and a half minutes of this crap? I mean, honestly, even just look, forget the fact that it ended up being a piece of trash. Just looking at it going, I'm sorry, honestly, Pete, like even in 1985 standards, you got to look at this and go, I probably better not give this 11 and a half minutes.
I would have given another 7 to fucking Spidey and Gibbs before I gave this thing 11. Like, I would rather.
I would have given 7 minutes to Jesse's bad selling before I would. I mean,
I was fucking done on this. You know, people say shit about Randy Orton's chin locks. Go watch this fucking match. You know what I mean? Like, this is a fucking boring chin lock. And then those botched roll ups are awful. And then the pin is just terrible. It's terrible. Fuck Cousin Jr. I feel completely, right and everything I've said, justified and everything I've said about him over the last few after watching this fucking disaster.
This is one of the worst pieces of crap. This may be the worst piece of crap we will ever see that doesn't involve the Sweeter.
That spoiler match we watched way back, that was pretty bad, right? That's the one we had named for originally. Who was that? Spoiler and...
Spoiler and... Shit. Let me look at the...
I got it right here. Spoiler and McGraw. Rick McGraw and Spoiler. That was our benchmark for the worst match we saw. I think this surpassed it. I think this was worse than that. Especially because you're trying to get Hercules over. That was just kind of a waste match. I mean, this is... You have a big debut. Freddie Blassie's out there. You know, Junior, regardless of what you think of him, the Hillbillies are still kind of a decent act. And to get this disaster in MSG is just... Yeah, not good.
To be fair to the Spoiler, he used to be good. So just... Let's just throw that out there, though.
It's a rough night, I guess. But this is, I mean, someone just, like, took a shit in everyone's Thanksgiving turkey with this fucking match. It's
awful. Let me ask you this, JR. Could this even be worse? I mean, remember, for a long time on our network adventures, the worst match ever was that Putski Baron von Raschke debacle from 77. I tell you, this
is that what? I think went 30 minutes or 20 minutes?
I think that's worse than this. I think
horribleness.
I think this 11 and a half minutes seem longer than that fucking
30
minutes. I don't
know. I think that Putski-Raschke match is worse than this. I mean, this was pretty bad, but I think that literally may be the worst match I've ever seen, that Putski-Raschke match.
Yeah, I had a kid at work who got the network, and he goes, man, I've heard your podcast, and I hear you're Mr. Old School. He goes, I checked out that Baron Raschke-Ivan Putski match. I go, well, don't judge old school wrestling on that thing. Thing is... terrible.
It's unwatchable trash. But anyway, this is unwatchable trash as well. Mm-hmm. Hercules gets the win. It's a dud. It's a piece of crap. Let's move on. Next up, JR, we have our first of two title matches this evening. Sure. Our ladies' championship is on the line. I haven't seen her in a while. What do we got?
We do have Wendi Richter, our women's champion, taking on the Mysterious Spider. And the seeds of what goes down here were sown during the Rock and Wrestling Connection Day, Scott, all the way back then. During that time, Wendi Richter was arguably on the same level as Hulk Hogan in terms of popularity at times. Association with Cyndi Lauper made her popular in the mainstream and made the draft lots of money. Problem was, Richter was not financially compensated on the same level as the male wrestlers. She was also initially losing part of her payday to Fabulous Moolah, since Richter had trained at her school. As we all know, Moolah gets her piece of flesh. Claimed that she was responsible for booking Richter as well. This was resolved when Richter got paid directly, but it was still less than she should have received, or at least that she felt she should have received. Relationship with Vince McMahon continued to sour. In late fall of 85, Richter refused to sign a contract extension until she was compensated better. As she was holding the women's title at the time, McMahon initiated a plan to take the title off of her without telling her, scheduled to face a Spider Lady tonight. The Spider character had started wrestling matches in WWF back in June, was sometimes associated with Fabulous Moolah in her matches, so there's nothing suspicious about Richter being booked in a match against this mysterious opponent. However, Richter later claimed that she felt something was up when she saw Moolah at the arena, as Moolah was not typically at shows unless she was scheduled to appear. The two were in the ring. Richter knew something was up since their competitor for the evening was shorter and heavier than the real Spider. After the final bell rang and the Spider Lady's mask was removed, it was clear that Richter had been screwed out of the title and she would not return until 2010 when she would be inducted into the Hall of Fame. So let's start with the match and then we can kind of break down everything that went down here with the screw job. First women's title match in a while on MSG. Jesse's now joined Gorilla in the booth. Richter is still using Lauper's music as a theme and gets a big pop as she charges out. Her opponent is the mysterious Spider, decked out in full black gear, mask included. Gorilla says Moolah has found the Spider and sent her out here to win the title. Richter dives the Spider. And by the way, Pete, is it Spider or Spider Lady? Because here they're calling her the Spider, but I always thought it was Spider Lady as well.
That's what I always thought it was Spider Lady, but yeah, I think it is just the Spider.
I was confused, too. I used to always think it was Spider Lady as well.
So Richter drives the Spider, spearing into the corner and pelting her with right hands. Spider bails to the floor as Richter tries to grab hold of her, sandwiching the referee in the process. Jesse wants to know what Spider did to make Wendy so irate. I think we know. Wendy follows outside and they brawl, ending with Wendy chasing her back in the ring. Wendy starts to work the leg, mixing submissions and strikes as Spider does whatever she can to escape. Spider breaks free and kicks and chokes her way into control. Wendy tries to rip off the mask, but Spider fends her off and keeps bringing the heat. Jesse says anytime someone goes after a mask, it backfires, and he wonders why anyone cares. Gorilla says it wouldn't surprise him if Moolah herself was under the mask tonight. I wonder if he knew. Wendy trembles to the floor, but comes back in with a dropkick and chucks Spider across the ring. Spider blocks a flying head scissors and falls on Wendy for two and then keeps kicking away. Spider keeps choking and going for covers, yanking on the hair as well. Wendy comes back with a clothesline for two, but Spider then rolls Wendy over with a small package for a clear two count as Wendy gets her shoulder up, but the ref counts three anyway and gives the match to the Spider. Gorilla and Jesse are completely lost and all kinds of confused as Wendy gets up and yanks Spider's mask off, revealing Moolah. Wendy just beats her all around the ring and covers her, but the referee just shoves her off the pin. Moolah celebrates and the ref gives her the belt, but Wendy attacks her again and takes the belt. The ref gets her from her and hands it to Moolah for the official announcement. Wendy snaps again and goes at Moolah, grabbing the belt and swinging it at her head. Moolah bails as Wendy stalks around the ring with the title. The match was terrible and only meaningful for the historical finish. The Wendy era is officially over, and it's kind of sad considering how high she was and how hot the women's stuff was. Moolah does the dirty work for Vince and takes back the gold. I went dud here. I don't know, Scott. Would you have paid for Richter, or do you think that her peak was over and that Vince was, I don't say justified in stripping her, but justified in refusing a raise? And what do you think of the match?
I gave it, you're going to think I'm nuts, but this, again, I'm prefacing. I'm giving it a star simply for historical purposes because the match was trash. To answer your question, yeah, I think you should have paid her. I think you should have. She was carrying that division, not Moolah. Moolah was the good heel, but we have to understand what the cosmetic makeup of this company was right now. She was the female Hogan. She was on TNT constantly. She was promoted as such.
Was she still, though?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
I think so. She was on TV a lot. I mean, she did have that stinker match.
Because, I mean, don't forget now, we're probably not going to have Lauper anymore. So is it diminishing returns? Like, have we peaked? Are you paying for past performance by paying her now? Yeah, I'm not going to argue that Vince shouldn't have owed her money, but if she wanted a raise or better compensation going forward, I don't know. I kind of can't blame him. I think she probably got about as hot as she could get with the Lauper and the rock and wrestling stuff. Like, I can't imagine her keeping all that up.
I think she should have at least gotten the opportunity. And then what he should have done was figured out how she could handle chasing again in 86. Because, let's be honest, Moolah's fucking, what is she, 60 at this point?
Yeah, I don't think it's anything to do with Moolah. Like, I don't think he was dying to get the title back on fucking Moolah. You know what I mean?
No, but I think what's up, what upsets me is Wendy seemed like a meter mover still for ticket sales. And while he was trying to cultivate some new heels, Wendy would have been a great, instead, as we're going to see, 1986 was fucking trash for the women's division.
Because you got some really, I mean, you got some pretty awful female wrestling in 86. We'll get to that as we document it. But I really do think she should have been given the opportunity. I think Vince listened to Moolah too much on this one. And again, obviously Moolah kind of in that scene.
I don't think he's listening to Moolah. I don't think Moolah was the one saying it.
I think she should
be fucking thrilled. She was getting a cut of the fucking money. I think Vince just didn't want to pay up. I think he was just being Vince. Like, just, I don't think I don't think you're worth the money. Like, what do you think, Pete?
I'm with you. I don't think Wendy Richter is worth the money at this point. I feel like her peak had peaked out. And by looking at the crowd, you're assuming she should be drawing little girls little girls and her parents. And I didn't see a lot of little girls in the audience here. And I think that's what she was drawing earlier with the first rub from Cyndi Lauper with the girls want to have fun video and all that stuff. And I think it's she worked her peak, and she wasn't like some super worker where she was so important to the card, having great matches where you needed her in that aspect. So no, I think her drawing went down. So it depends. I mean, it all depends on how much money she wanted. I honestly don't think her drawing was as important at that point anymore. And she had definitely wasn't going to be headlining any shows. So, I mean, you had your world title, your tag belt, and your IC belt were going to be the main events on the three big shows that they're running each day, or the two shows. So Richter kind of, I don't think she meant squat at this point.
Do you think Moolah had say in it, or do you think this is Vince?
I think Moolah was just the passer through, and she would do dirty business for Vince, and she was just happened to be the one who would be willing to screw Wendy over.
Right.
I don't think at all that Moolah had any say whatsoever. I think Vince just didn't want to pay as much money as what Wendy thought she was worth. And now Wendy was probably worth that in 84, or 6 months after the angle, and maybe even a year, but right now it's what were we at here? About a year and a half past the angle, or about a year now?
From which angle?
For which angle?
When Richter got hot with the first Cyndi, when Ward settled the score rub.
Yeah, not even a year. It's like February.
Well, it's February, but I mean, she beat Moolah in July, so technically that kind of started. It's been almost a year and a half, I guess, at this point. I guess, all right, well, you bring up an interesting another side point, Pete, because you're saying that the tag, the IC, and obviously the world title are good enough on shows. So do you think he should have just dumped the women's division altogether then?
I'm a firm believer where you didn't need to have the title, but I'm a firm also back in the 80s, women still would draw if used properly and used sporadically. If you brought in a women's match and it was the right women, maybe once every 4 months, then it was kind of like the midgets in a way as a novelty act. I'm a firm believer in using them in that aspect, and it wouldn't really matter if it was Moolah or the Jumping Bomb Angels or Leilani Kai or whoever back then could have fit. But the Bomb Angels were great workers, so they're actually actually helping the card for the action part of it that Wendy and Moolah and them did not. So it all depends on using them as a novelty act, and I don't think they needed an actual division per se.
Well, then why did he have to pull all this crap? Why didn't he just say, your contract's up, we're ditching the title, so you can either just work dates and leave, or why did he got to do this whole...
But that's my opinion. He didn't. He still wanted the title. He still wanted to use the title. And so he wanted it off Wendy without paying her.
Because fuck you, pal!
Didn't want to do business in a way also. Like, she obviously, he could have let her go, but she wasn't going to do the job, it sounds like.
Well, if that's the case, now see, we haven't talked about that. That hasn't seemed to be what – it seems just more that she thought that she got her way and I'm just defending the title and this is a title defense and blah, blah, blah. And instead he just, swiped the belt from her and dumped her.
I don't think she thought she got her way. I'm guessing she probably thought they were just still at an impasse. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think she was expecting to get paid. She probably just figured, all right, another night, we'll get back to the negotiating table tomorrow kind of thing. You know what I mean? So I don't think she thought she won by any means.
And women had no power back then in the 80s.
She was really the only one. Yeah.
She was the only one who had power. Everyone else was a piece of beef or a side item where you could just, take it or leave it. Yeah, they got scraps forever. And so Vince Chernek wasn't going to set the precedent of being the first person to actually pay out big money for a woman wrestler and set that precedent. Because you also got to think, I mean, you're able to pay all these other females X amount. Why should I pay this person who really is not significantly drawing anymore? I could understand that the first 6 months or 8 months of that angle, but it had run its course at that point, and you weren't going to get Lauper coming back, which was a key part of the act. Yeah, she got the rub already, but, I mean, it was really kind of Cindy was drawing. Well, it was Cindy Lauper, the rub of Cindy Lauper that was drawing, and then, and, you know, the further Cindy was away from the angle, the less and less Wendy was getting over.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. I just think that if Vince had any idea that he wanted some kind of a substantive women's division, he should have just let kind of Wendy work it out and then, you know, play out her dates, drop the belt, and leave.
I don't think he wanted it that bad. Like, I think he wanted the women's title, but I don't think he saw it as like any, I don't know. I think you're way overestimating Wendy Richter, to be honest with you. I think anyone could have been with Cindy Lauper and been fine. Like Velvet McIntyre or one of these other, you know, women.
But I'm still kind of confused. I guess this is different than what the next one of these would be 12 years later.
Yeah.
yes. Like, why? Then what's the big fucking deal then? Like, why do that? Why not? Stripper and
get the belt
and fire?
Because you gotta think you can't. It's not like today. You know what I mean? Like, Vince. It was a Wild West. He needed to assert himself at the time, and promoters did this shit often. Like, I don't want to say to this point, but he had to show that he was still the guy in charge, that he wasn't going to let wrestlers, you know, fucking beat him in the locker room or beat him for money, and he had to prove a point. So Wendy Richter ran her mouth. She wouldn't accept what he was offering, so he fucked her. I mean, that was it. Like, I think it's as simple as that. Like, it was a power play by Vince to show who the fucking boss was. It's not her. It's not anyone else. If you're gonna screw with me, everyone's replaceable. Like, I think he just proved a point. Like, I think you're way over thinking like what Richter meant to him. I don't think he gave a shit.
Yeah, and I think in Vince's mind, and I know, I mean, he's proven this, that he's taken. That's why till this day he still doesn't take gimmicks from other promotions like War Games, because it wasn't his idea. I feel he feels like I can make Wendy a star. I'll get rid of her and I'll make somebody else a star. It's the WWF machine, and his Midas touch is what makes the stars. And that's why him and Hogan had so many issues back in the 90s and stuff. And they've had problems here and there. It was because Hogan thought he was the driving force, while Vince thought he was the one who created Hogan in a way, you know. And I think that all goes back to everything, where Vince, he's the alpha male, and no one's going to tell him, he can make or break you. And I think this is him just showing you, I broke you.
All right. I mean, obviously, because as we see as 1986 continues, the women's division just gets flushed down the fucking toilet. So
yeah,
I mean, I don't know if he meant if his plan was to just let the
Richter
women's
really
division
makes a difference. I mean, it's. I don't think he gets flushed
on
the toilet.
Yes, because the baby faces in 86 were terrible.
But I don't think that mattered. Like, he could have made Velvet McIntyre fucking great or whatever. I mean, I just don't think he gave a shit anymore.
Absolutely not.
Yes.
She had no charisma.
What charisma did Richter have? She fucking got carried by Cindy Lauper, worked circles around her in the fucking ring when she was out there charisma-wise. Look, I'm really not trying to diminish Wendy that much. I mean, she was serviceable. But, I mean, you're acting like he let fucking, you know, Giant Baba walk out the door. I mean, he didn't give a shit.
No. But my point is, what none of the three of us can answer is, what was the end game for the women's division? If he was planning, if 1986 was what he was expecting, then all right, well, whatever then. And you pretty much gave up on the division. And that was that. You had a 61-year-old, 62-year-old woman being your women's champion for like 9 months. But if you're only wrestling like, you know,
you
three
can argue
times
Moolah
a month,
had
then whatever.
More name value than anyone else. I mean, as you know, as a draw, who could beat Moolah? Like, to me, that's I think if Richter didn't run her mouth and just shut up and paid what he wanted to pay, or, you know, I think she would have been there. So, like, I don't think he wanted to get rid of her. But when you're weighing the balances of saying, all right, you know, she's running her mouth, I don't need her starting trouble in the locker room, getting other people thinking, getting the other women thinking, getting the other undercard guys thinking, oh, you know, I should be getting paid more. And then Vince gave in to her. Like, I think it was just, no, he's putting his dick on the table and saying, this is my locker room. I own it. And that's 80s Vince. Like, that's it. I mean, it was the Wild West at that point. I think it was just him saying, everybody is replaceable. You're replaceable. I don't care. about the women's division, A, that much, and B, if I do, I'll find someone else to take your spot. I'll bring Cyndi Lauper back and have her endorse somebody else. You know, like, I just think he didn't give a shit. Like, I think he was, it was more important to him not to lose control of his talent than it was for him to actually keep fucking Wendi Richter on the roster.
Yeah, and the belt really never meant anything coming into until they ended up bringing it really off of mothballs to put it in part of this angle with Cyndi Lauper. I mean, it really hadn't meant nothing for the company forever. And then all of a sudden, yeah, the belt got a little hot. I mean, got a little rub for maybe 6 months to a year, but then it lost its luster and meant nothing again. And it's not like there was like all these women vying for the belt. So it was like a one or two pony show. And I'm with and Richter got the rub. That's when they put the sunglasses on her and gave her kind of a gimmick. Cause I've seen her in Houston on the NWA On Demand as cowgirl Wendi Richter. And she showed no charisma. She just got lightning in a bottle here and they, and she got hot for a little bit. And it's kind of, I don't know what to compare it to, but it was kind of like a flash in the pan in a way.
I think
I know she was on that. I know
like
she was,
Cyndi Lauper, you know,
I know she was on a heel team in AWA. I think it was Super Sunday, the Hogan Bockwinkle. I think Super Sunday,
Super Brawl Saturday.
Super, I don't know, but I think she was a. I guess all right. So
I think the problem, Scott, is that you're looking at the women's division as having been the draw, or having like mattered. None of it mattered. Cyndi Lauper and the Rock and Wrestling Connection are what mattered. They could have had her out there with fucking Gibbs, Terry Gibbs. You know what I mean? Like whoever they had her with was going to be the draw. Like it worked that they had a, you know, attractive, athletic woman that was, you know, passable enough in the ring that could get that whole girl power thing with Cyndi Lauper. But I mean, Lauper was the draw. Like it had nothing to do with the women's division, had nothing to do with the women's title, and nothing to do with Leilani Kai. You know, Moolah was hateable. Lou Albano was involved because he was in the music video.
Yeah.
And then Cyndi Lauper was just a fucking megastar who happened to give her time to wrestling. And yeah, Wendi Richter was right place, right
time. I think you hit it right there with Captain Lou because he was a big-time heel. And I think he was very important. It was actually the key cog in that angle until they finally turned him babyface, which, you know, helped to extend the angle. Because, I mean, Lou was a big-time drawing heel in that territory, and I think that had more to do with it than actually Wendi Richter. And she just happened to be – she was Greg Brady who fit the suit on that Brady Bunch episode when he was Johnny Bravo. That's what Wendi Richter kind of felt like. And we've seen Vince. He didn't – he really – I mean, you think about it. The belt got hot there, disappeared for a while. They tried it anywhere else, didn't work. Finally, they brought in – Medusa, the Lunder Blaze, I got hot for maybe a little bit. They got rid of it again, and then they finally got hot with the hot women doing, you know, bathing suit matches and stuff, and then Trish kind of made it semi-important, and then it didn't get really hot again until really, when you think about it, maybe AJ Lee, until Hunter and them started pushing them in the NXT division, and then it became important again. So, I mean, it's never been like a key part of WWF's lore.
All right, well, if then I'll acquiesce in the sense that if we think that he didn't give a shit about the division anymore, then really the whole thing is kind of moot. But the question, kind of the specifics on the match itself, do either of you think that Gorilla and Jesse knew?
Yeah, I think Gorilla knew.
See, I do and I don't. Because I feel like, why would he say the Moolah thing if he didn't just stumble into thinking it was her and thinking it was some kind of angle? Like, I feel like he wouldn't have brought it up. And
well, see, that's the thing. I think Gorilla's that guy who wants to be the smartest guy in the
true
room.
Yeah, true. No, yeah, that's a good point.
And I think that's why he said it. And you know what? They're not going to hear on commentary the girls in the ring.
But do you think he would? I mean, they sounded so confused and stupid on commentary. I feel like he wouldn't have been able to play as dumb as he did if he didn't know. Like, they seem so lost on what's going on. That I don't know, that part made me think he didn't know. But you're right. I mean, he is kind of the I want to be the smartest guy in the room kind of thing. So it's possible he knew.
And he was part of the inner circle then, too, right. You know.
Yeah. No, you're right. There's a good chance he knew. I don't know about Jesse.
I wonder if Jesse didn't.
I don't think
I bet Jesse
did.
Didn't.
I don't think Jesse did, just because I think Vince considered him still one of the boys. He went and he was in office. Gorilla Monsoon was making percentages on the house show and actually did the payoffs and stuff like that. And so there's a big difference between the two and knowing future plans and stuff.
Mm. All right. So the Spider, or I guess it is Moolah now technically. Moolah is once again your World Wrestling Federation ladies champion, and we will never see, or we shouldn't say never, but we will not see Wendi Richter on WWF live television again until 2010, right? Is that when she went in the Hall of Fame?
Yep.
2010.
Spidey saves the day. There you go.
25 years.
But I'll tell you, on the finish, where I think what happened was they told Wendi that it would be a roll-up, 1-2, kick out, you get up and unmask her. Because I think that was part of the act, and I think she was told it was Moolah. Honestly, I think Wendy's recollection is a little wrong, because by looking at the finish, looks like she was supposed to kick out 1-2 and then unmask her, right, and the match gets thrown out, and when it's revealed to be Moolah, but they double crossed her on the pin.
Yeah, because she keeps going and then kind of realizes what's going on a minute later when the belt. And
then she starts just taking the belt and just beating her with it.
She's
like,
pissed, yeah. And then when the ref throws her off during the pin and everything too, the whole thing just fell apart.
Yeah.
All right, next we have our second title match of the evening. There'll be no screw jobs here. Well, not intentional, I guess. Intentionally planned, but we'll get some good workers in the ring, JR. What do we got?
We have our tag team title match, the Dream Team, our champions, taking on the Latin Sensations, Tito Santana and Pedro Morales. Interesting tag title match, the IC champ teaming with the legendary Pedro for what crack at more gold. Good heat on the champs, accompanied by Johnny V as always. We get some posturing until V finally leaves and Pedro and Hammer open things up. Jesse says the challengers have an advantage because they can speak Spanish and the champs won't be able to understand. We get a lockup that ends in the corner of the champs, allowing Pedro to land a shot on Beefcake. Pedro punches away and hits an atomic drop, but Hammer makes it to the corner to regroup. Pedro grabs a headlock and tags in Tito, who also grabs a headlock. Hammer takes Tito down with a single leg and tries to the figure four, but Tito kicks free and punches Hammer down. Tito went to the arm as Gorilla put over Valentine's resiliency. The crowd rallies Tito as Hammer smashes him with a back elbow and tags out. Tito caught Brutus coming in and went to work on his arm before hitting an atomic drop. Pedro tags in and the challengers clean house on both champs. Morales keeps bringing the heat to Brutus, smacking him around the ring. The challengers take turns punishing the arm and watch each other's back, with Tito stepping into the ring anytime Hammer tries to make the save. Hammer comes into strike, sneaking in a blow on Pedro to turn the tide. The champs beat Pedro in the corner, with Hammer eventually knocking Pedro to the floor with a hard right elbow to the face. Pedro makes it back inside, but Hammer starts levying heavy blows before tagging in Beefer, who did the same thing in between strutting. Beefcake starts to target the leg and tags in Hammer, who also smacked Tito to block a tag on the other end. Pedro blocks the figure four, but then scampers over to make the tag. The crowd is all fired up as Tito mows through both champs with the right hands and slams, and then drills Hammer with a flying forearm. Tito covers, but Beefcake makes a save, followed by a big brawl by all four. Tito gets to figure four, but Johnny V gets in the ring and gets drilled by Pedro, and the chaos continues until the ref just throws the match out. This was fine. I had some good energy and heat. It's always good to see Tito and Hammer, but I don't know. I feel like it just never really got going. Pedro looks okay, and they're trying to protect him a bit. The Dream Team retains. I just went one star on this, Scott. I wanted to like it, but I feel like it never got moving. We didn't get enough Tito Hammer. Everyone looked a little bit out of sorts. I don't know if they were confused about the match happened before them or what, but this is kind of the worst we've seen from the Dream Team so far.
I liked it. I gave it 2 stars. I thought it was pretty good. I thought the crowd really got into it. I don't know if Tito Valentine was meant to continue anyway, because we are 5 months after the title change.
Yeah,
they
still
want
to go at it. They're in there.
You do.
Rivals.
Oh, no, I agree. I'm just saying it wasn't necessary to the match, in my opinion. I thought it was a good mix. I think Pedro has kind of gotten out of, I think he's gotten the cobwebs out, and I'm very impressed. I have been very impressed with Brutus. He's paying attention to his mentors, and he's putting on some pretty awesome matches, relatively speaking, I guess. So I gave it 2 stars. Pete, what'd you think?
I liked it better than both of you guys. I gave it 2.5. Clearly, Valentine's carrying the load for the Dream Team, but I feel Beefcake is coming along and he's picking his spots and being able to carry the action in his spots. But Valentine's clearly carrying the load, like we see here we get the early shine and Valentine stooging for Morales, and now Morales tags out, and then Valentine is shining up Tito. So we actually have a pretty nice shine segment for the baby faces, and they do a nice job where they tease the heat, but only for the faces to remain in control. I like that, where it looks like they're about to get the heat, but no, they pull the rug out from underneath the heels. And I like the faces focusing on the arm, and they're working the arm. And then you see finally Valentine cheats to set up the heat, which I always like. I hate when heels transition into the heat without cheating, where they just do it normally. I'm a firm believer in your heel cheat. Get some heat. Get the crowd booing you. They were at the King of the Mountain spots, and I'm not a big fan of those. I feel like they're ways to catch your breath or to eat some time up, but they're never really truly engaging. I loved Valentine's cutoff of that tag, where it looked like Morales finally is about to make the hot tag, but Valentine runs and knocks Tito off the apron. I really like that. And then when finally gets the tag to Tito, the crowd's 100% with it, with him. And then we build it to the schmoz finish. But I really enjoyed it. And the Dream Team is like a team that really people don't talk about them well enough when it comes to, you always hear about the Hart Foundation and the Rockers and the Bulldogs and Demolition. I would put the Dream Team as, I honestly think they're, I think they might be behind maybe the Rockers. I think the Dream Team put on better matches than the Hart Foundations and the Bulldogs on a regular basis, honestly.
No, they have been enjoyable. I really dug seeing more and more of their work. I don't know what it is, but I wish this match was as good as you described it as in my mind, Pete, because you made it sound a lot more exciting. I really enjoyed them, and I think you're absolutely right with Beefcake. He is slowly really starting to put it together, and like you said, he's smart about where he picks his spots and comes in. You can see that Valentine sets him up and preps him, and I think it was a real shrewd move to put these guys together. I thought Valentine needed something to do after he finally got out of the Tito feud, and helping groom Beefcake and also be a tag team champion was a good move. Interesting use for Tito this month, too, but it was cool. It was cool seeing him in Pedro's team. For whatever reason, I just couldn't get into the match.
I did like Jesse's little thing about why Tito would bring his own belt out for a match. Because historically, throughout history, at least the Federation era, whenever a champion, like Hogan never brought his belt out, I don't think, when he was in tags. Maybe 50-50. I guess a tag title match is a different beast, and Hogan wasn't in those a lot. But I do notice historically in the Federation era that singles champions that were in tags usually didn't bring their belts out. And it was funny that Jesse actually brought that up. I thought it was pretty funny. So there you go. The Dream Team keeps the belts. They lose the match by DQ and continue cruising along as our heel tag team champs, obviously looking for new babyface number one contenders since our defending champion or our past champions are obviously not around. All right, this is probably the intermission because we have some interviews coming up shortly, but let's take a break. Mm-hmm. You sound slightly disappointed, JR, in the show so far.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's been very good. I think it's been a lot of a lot of poor matches. Usually we have that one, at least one big anchor match in the first half to keep things chugging along. I think the longest matches have been the worst. I think that Abomination of Hercules match is dragging things down. I mean, we had the screw job, but even that match blew. I just we'll see. Hopefully it gets better, but I haven't been feeling it thus far.
Okay. What do you think so far, Pete?
It's been terrible. there's no sugarcoating it. The best match by far was that tag match, and in my opinion, but everything else has been just utter garbage. And even with the history of the spider stealing the screw job of Wendy Richter, that didn't save it. It just terrible wrestling up and down so far. One of the worst front halves of a card you could possibly. Mm-hmm. I think you could. I mean, honestly, I think. I think Parv could have booked his fantasy WWE when he retired Bruno better, and he almost got thrown out of fired. He lost Madison Square Garden. This is terrible.
All right. Well, we got three more matches to go. We'll see if anything. See if it picks up at all. And of course, we'll have our pop culture report. But first, let's break. Because,
hey, new break, first time here.
Sorry, I'm not who I know. I'm walking in this battle with the promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuestas podcast, The Military-Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
This is the King of Old School, Steve Carino, the true voice of Ring of Honor, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
We are back checking out the November 1985 Madison Square Garden House Show. Scott, myself, Justin, of course, joining us. One of the former Titans and current co-hosts of This Week in Wrestling and Space City, and that is Pete Schirmacher, one of our top correspondents at Clotheslines and Headlines, which will return this Wednesday. And be having our buddy Brandon Howard on to talk a little business when it comes to WWE. We can talk about the network subscriptions and WrestleMania Week success. And we'll also be breaking down our thoughts on the weekend, the Superstar Shakeup, and everything that goes along with it. So. Should be a lot of fun. Of course, as you're waiting for that, check out Main Event last week. That was a look as well. So there you go.
Yes.
So, Scott, earlier on we talked about Dan Spivey. part of the tag team American Starship, and very few people know that Dan Spivey and American Starship sang the number one song for this week. We built this city, right? That's them?
Yes.
We built this, Spivey. We built this. Big development on Raw here, guys. They're in the Superstar Shakeup here. Yeah, that is our number one song. Many consider it like the worst song like in the history of pop music. It was one of the, I think it was the song that broke the band up, but it was number one last week as well. Number two, the late great, the late great Glenn Frey of the Eagles. Solo career full swing in 1985. You Belong to the City. At number three, JR, we had a little music movie correlation. Number three is a song, Separate Lives, which was a duet by Phil Collins and Marilyn Martin, which comes from a movie. We're going to talk about that movie shortly, so I won't mention it now. And number four, another great 80s stalwart, Broken Wings by Mr. Mister. Oh. At number five.
They lifted by Tupac, of course.
Yes. Yep. Number five, Never by Heart, which is a tremendous song as they did their kind of their pop love song reboot in the 80s. Number six, the Thompson Twins with Lay Your Hands on Me, not to be confused with the tremendously awesome Bon Jovi track on New Jersey 3 years later. Number seven, Head Over Heels by Tears for Fears. Number eight, JR's favorite song, Jan Hammer's Miami Vice theme.
Yes.
Number nine, the incredibly annoying song by Aretha Franklin. By Aretha Franklin. Who's Zooming Who? Who's Zooming Who? That movie, I hated that song so much. And at number 10, dropping five spots, Part-Time Lover by Stevie Wonder. So we're coming to the end of the year, JR. So probably on our next vault, we'll have the we'll do that week's top 10, and we'll do the final top 10 of 1985.
We mentioned Phil Collins, big in 1990, SummerSlam. Our foundation quoting him left and right. So throwing that out there as a tease for our SummerSlam project that's coming. But those who know will know.
I'm really sad about that list. I've seen two of the acts live in the last like 4 years at concerts. I've seen Stevie Wonder and the Eagles.
I thought you were going to say the Thompson Twins.
Yeah, the Thompson Twins. I have some taste.
Miss Aretha Franklin. All right. So there was your top 10.
I've seen Aretha. My bad. Yeah, I've seen three of them. My bad.
And of course, so there's your top. There was your up-to-date Billboard top 10 that came out the previous Saturday. This was a Monday house show. The previous Saturday, November 23rd. All right, JR, are you ready? This should be a lot of fun. Can't wait to see you try to hack some of these foreign names. I guarantee a couple of them are foreign movies. Six movies came out the previous Friday, the 22nd. Here we go. In sixth place, it made $610,333. It is a drama called Fever Pitch.
Oh, Jimmy Fallon.
I don't know, wasn't the name of that terrible movie with the Red Sox?
1985 did star Ryan O'Neill, directed and written by Richard Brooks. Final film for Brooks, director of such acclaimed pictures as Blackboard Jungle, Elmer Gantry, and Cat in a Hot Tin Roof, starring Brenda Walsh. Sports writer Steve Taggart volunteers to do a series of articles for the Los Angeles Herald Examiner about a compulsive gambler he calls Mr. Green, who is in fact himself, and becomes obsessed with gambling, landing him deeply in debt, compounding his money and gambling problems by dealing with associated with loan sharks, including the most dangerous L.A. bookmaker known as the Dutchman, Chad Everett. Also starring Catherine Hicks as Flo, Giancarlo Gianni as Charlie, Brigitte Anderson as Amy, Chad Everett, John Saxon, Hank Greenspan, Will Smith, not that Will Smith, Keith Hefner, Patrick Cassidy, William Prince, and Chad McQueen.
Keith Hefner? Like Hugh's kid? Interesting. All right, at number five, making $3 million $360,800, an adventure film called Star Chaser, The Legend of Orin. O-R-I-N, Orin.
Let's look that one up. Star Chaser, The Legend of Orin. An animated science fiction adventure film written by animation writer Jeffrey Scott. Also later note for Radio Visual, the movie. It was originally released in 3D by Atlantic Releasing.
They were in Amsterdam?
In the future, on a planet named Trinia, human slaves have lived underground for millennia mining crystals for a god named Zygon and his robot minions. One day, Orin, a young miner, finds a jeweled sword embedded in the rocks. Hops, grandfather of Orin's girlfriend, Elon, recognizes the sword, blah, 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 from there. Joe Colligan, Carmen Argaziano, Anthony DeLongis, Noel North, Tyke Caravelli, and no one else anyone's ever heard of.
I bet you Tom Burke liked the movie. All right. At number four, making $4,549,195, a comedy called Bad Medicine. What's all the veiled Bon Jovi references tonight? Right? The songs from the New Jersey album. That's two now.
Bad Medicine. Let's look it up. It's also American Monster Truck Bad Medicine, by the way. Did you know that?
Yes, there was.
All right. Starring our buddy Steve Guttenberg, as well as Alan Arkin and Julie Haggerty. So, decent names in this movie. The film was criticized for its negative ethnic stereotype. Sounds like it fits right in, 30 of 1985. Below-average pre-med student Jeffrey Marks, after being rejected by prestigious medical schools, is sent by his father, Bill Macy, to seemingly substandard medical school in Central America. Jeffrey eventually discovers the plight of local villagers in need of medical assistance. Guttenberg, Arkin, and Haggerty, the only ones listed here. So,
yeah. And Booger from Revenge of the Nerds is in it, too.
Oh, nice. There you go.
Oh, what's that guy's name? I can't remember.
Curtis Armstrong.
He
made his great return from Supernatural and that funny comedy. Who's that girl? She's that whatever the with the cute girl. I can't remember.
Jill St. John.
Jill St. John.
All right. At number three, this made 13. Actually, these top three actually made decent money. $13,229,514. A drama titled One Magic Christmas. Oh, here you go, JR. Right up your alley. A little seasonal action here.
Let's see. One Magic Christmas. 1985 American-Canadian Christmas Fantasy, directed by Phil Borzos, released by Disney, starring Mary Steenburgen, Harry Dean Stanton, shot in Medford, Ontario. Ginny Granger is a mother of two children, Cal and Abby, and her husband Jack has been out of work since June, and they have to move out of the company house by January 1st. Jack fixes bikes as a hobby in the basement and hopes to give one to his children's poor friend, Molly Monaghan, for Christmas, although he'd like to open a bike shop of his own. Mary Steenburgen, Gary Basaraba, Harry Dean Stanton, Arthur Hill, Robbie Magwood, Elizabeth Harnois, Michelle Meyrink, Elias Codius, no one else, Graham Jarvis, father of Jeff, and that's about it.
Father of Jeff. All right. Number two, this made $15,057,465, an adventure film entitled King Solomon's Mines.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Here we go. The 1985 version was also the fourth of five film adaptions of the 1885 novel. So they've done this thing five times. Starring Richard Chamberlain, Sharon Stone, Herbert Lom, John Rhys-Davies. Jesse Hutton hires Alan Quatermain to find her father, believed lost on an expedition to find the fabled King Solomon's Mines. Together with his companion, the mysterious Ubumpu, they penetrate unknown country, following a map believed to be genuine. It transpires that Professor Hudson has been captured by a German military expedition on the same quest. So is this always the whole Mr. Livingston, I presume, is that this is based on? The whole no?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
All right.
Alan Quatermain was
one of Sharon Stone's first credits. I remember that because I fell in love instantly when I saw her before Basic Instinct and Total Recall.
To love that.
Yeah, she was in a couple other things in the late 80s, too.
Yeah.
And the number one movie.
No one else.
The number one
By the way, there's a character named Rug Carrier, so there you go.
Well. And at number one for the weekend, it made $42,160,849. We mentioned a song number three on the Billboard charts, sung by Phil Collins and Marilyn Martin. The movie was called, it was a thriller suspense film called White Knights. Pete knows what I'm talking about. You know the movie.
I believe I do.
Well, he's on a lot of message boards, so I mean that's where the White Knight is where they reside there on Twitter. Is it let's see, White Knights? That's it? Or Knights?
Yes.
Knights.
Oh yeah,
Knights,
I remember
Knights like day and night, not Knights like
really
Columbus.
Fun movie at the time.
Like of Columbus.
Should have
your piece of work. All right, White Knight.
You asked.
1985 film. Directed by Taylor Hackford, choreographed by Twyla Tharp. Nicole, did we already talk about this one? I thought we talked about this one.
With what's his name? Gregory Hines and
Baryshnikov. Didn't we talk about this already? Did it get released foreign before it came out here? Yeah, Russia.
It might have. Yeah, it might have, actually.
We talked about it got released when foreign. It came out in Russia. I remember talking about this.
Yeah.
I think I made the same exact White Knight joke.
Well, so it came out in America that previous weekend, and it made $42 million, so there you go. And so there's your movies for the weekend. And JR, I'll mention this now since it we just missed it by 5 days because it – let's see. What'd you say? Oh, well, this makes sense. Coming out the night before Thanksgiving, on the 27th, right? You said the 20th. So 2 days after this house show and the night before Thanksgiving, guess what was released? Rocky Four.
Oh, nice.
No, no, Stockade. No, Rocky Four.
Very good.
So there you go.
Epic.
All right. Are you ready? You're now going from the theater to the gridiron because it's time to take the field. It is week 12. There we go. It is week 12 of the 1985 football season. You've done pretty good the last couple of weeks, Jer. Of course, you're on a roll. Pete's team, of course.
I'm going to take my hot tub time machine back in time and make some money.
Okay, Biff. of course, Pete's beloved Bears kicking ass and taking names in 1985.
Super Bowl, yeah, making their Super Bowl run, man.
So here we go, JR. You ready?
Yes.
We begin. This was, of course, games all the day before. We begin at the Astrodome in Houston, where the Oilers host the San Diego Chargers.
I go with the Coryell Chargers and Fouts, but I'm going to take Houston at home.
Houston wins 37-35, typical shootout. Fouts did throw for 343 yards in that game, but the Oilers win by two. We now go to Soldier Field in Chicago, where Pete's Bears take on Chad's Coldlanta Falcons.
Chicago.
Take 30, that, Campbell.
36-0.
Eat it from the pass, Campbell.
So they were up 36-0 and didn't blow it, huh?
Nope, they did not.
Atlanta should have taken notes.
The Bears win, and guess who that day, Pete, threw for 151 yards for the Bears that day? It was not Jim McMahon. Guess who started? Do you remember the backup?
Yeah, Steve Fuller.
Mr. Steve Fuller. Yep, so they got the win. All right, JR, hot game in the Meadowlands. Your Jets, 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 taking on the New England Patriots. So even in 1985, the hatred ran deep.
Give me the Jets at home.
In overtime, it was Pat Leahy with a 32-yard field goal. Jets win 16-13.
Take that, Belichick.
Ken O'Brien threw. Belichick. He was coaching a lot in that building, but not for the Jets. Kenny O'Brien threw for three. Kenny O'Brien threw for 311 yards, and your boy Wesley Walker.
Yes,
168 receiving, including an 88-yard touchdown pass.
Who was the running back there back then? You remember? Was it Freeman McNeil?
Freeman McNeil. I have the line score in front of me, because I wanted to say something funny. Freeman McNeil only had 9 yards rushing. He must have been hurt that day. But guess who rushed for 97 yards? The iconic Johnny Hector.
Ooh,
97 yards for the Jets that day. Next, we go to the Homer Dome in Minneapolis, where the Vikings host New Orleans.
Oof, Vikings.
Saints win 30-23.
They never win in the 80s.
I know. I didn't think so either. Bullshit. Tommy Kramer threw for 240 in the loss. Next, we go to Municipal Stadium in Cleveland, the Dog Pound, where the Browns host the Bengals in another hated rivalry.
Yeah, I'm going to take the Browns at home, hold and serve in the rivalry game.
Browns win big, 24-6.
Fuck you, Boomer.
We go down to Rich Stadium in Buffalo. The Bills host Dan Marino and the Dolphins.
Miami.
Dolphins win 23-14. Let's go to Three River Stadium in Pittsburgh, where the Steelers host Washington.
Oof, I'll take the Hogs at home. Oh, wait, so the Steelers are home?
Yes.
I'll take the Hogs anyway.
Hogs win 30-23. Let's go down to the Sombrero in Tampa, the Bucks hosting Detroit.
I'm going to say Detroit went down there and smacked those bitches up.
Bucks win in overtime, 19-16.
These scrub teams are not supposed to win. Throw me off.
Let's go out to Anaheim, where the Rams host Green Bay.
I will take the Rams at home.
Eric Dickerson rushes for .50. Rams win 34-17. Speaking of Bill Belichick, his New York football Giants in St. Louis to take on the Cardinals.
I think the Giants go on the road and win that game.
Giants roll 34-3. We go to the Coliseum where the Raiders host John Elway and the Broncos.
Oof. Elway goes in there and beats the Raiders.
Third overtime game of the weekend, and the Raiders win 31-28. We go down to Big D to the hole in the roof where the Cowboys take on the piece of crap Philadelphia Eagles.
I'll go with the Cowboys, Scott.
Cowboys win 34-17, even though Ron Jaworski, that piece of trash, threw for 285. We go now to Arrowhead where the Chiefs host the Colts in a battle of two really awful football teams.
Chiefs at home.
Chiefs win 20-7. And finally, Monday night from the stick, your defending world champion San Francisco 49ers take on the Seattle Seahawks.
I will take the Niners on Monday night at home.
Niners win 19-6.
I'm getting really fucking good at this. I've only got three wrong.
Yeah, you did pretty good. A couple of the usual stinkers kind of caught up, snuck up on you, but not bad though. Not bad at all.
Okay,
bad
really cleaned up in 85.
Yes. Quiet in both the NBA and the NHL. Just one game on tap tonight. The Jazz beat the Pacers 102-101. So pretty good game at Market Square Arena in Indianapolis. And one game in the NHL, the North Stars beat the Sabres 4-3 in Buffalo. And finally, your second week of the college basketball season. Here is your top 10, 1-10, North Carolina, Georgia Tech, Michigan, Syracuse, Kansas, Duke, Illinois, Georgetown, Louisville, and Kentucky. There's your top 10 in college basketball for that week. And that is your pop culture report for this week, or for tonight, November 25th, 1985.
All right, let's head to the locker room. Gorilla Monsoon on an interview rampage here. Heads backstage, talks to Bobby Heenan about the big six-man tag coming up tonight. Bobby says he'll be the smartest man in the ring and takes digs at their opponents and then gives him some game plan hints out as well. Gorilla then talks to Terry Funk and Jimmy Hart. Hart gives Gorilla some shit as Hart threatens to have Funk unmask Mr. Wrestling 2. Funk talks about Saturday's main event, and Gorilla laughs about what happened to Jimmy. Funk brags about beating JYD and says anyone remembers is JYD humiliating 157-pound guy. Funk threatens to beat up Gorilla and vows to be Hulk Hogan and get even with the jackass JYD. Gorilla then talks to Captain Lou Albano, who calls Jesse despicable. Gorilla puts over Lou's tutelage over Andre and, oh God, over Andre the Giant and Hillbilly Jim. Albano says he can't handle Stutter Bundy, but he can handle Heenan, and he wants revenge when the brand attacked him during the Manager of the Year ceremony. He says Andre and Hillbilly are at 100%, and Albano says he has lost 30 pounds while training for this match. Not quite. Usual Albano rambling closes things up here.
And did he call Captain Lou, Gorilla Mean Gene at one point?
He did say Gene. Yeah, yeah. I thought he was trying. I thought maybe he was saying Gino, and he just didn't get it out because he's a sloppy pig with marbles in his mouth.
Or, eight vodkas in.
Well, that too. Yeah, probably the thing, but eight ball. we get back to the ring, JR, for our second half of our show, and maybe a match, JR, that will boost things a little bit here. What do we got?
Sure should, and that is the continuation of our feud between Ricky Steamboat and the Magnificent Morocco. Steamboat gets a big pop as he enters, as always. Mr. Fuji settles in at ringside as Jesse asks Gorilla if he would buy a car from Fuji, and Gorilla says he wouldn't even drive in a car with him. That was a good line. Morocco begs off to start as Steamboat stalks him. Morocco engages, but Steamboat catches him with a leaping kick that knocks him outside the ring. Steamboat follows and chases him right back in, and we get a lockup that Morocco wins. Morocco snaps Steamer down and drops a hard knee, but Steamer fights right back and snaps Morocco's neck. Morocco bails and regroups before coming back in and begging off some more. Steamboat brings the fight right to him, chopping away and locking in a neck vice before Morocco escapes and regroups. Steamboat continues to dominate and keeps Morocco off balance, leading into a modified STF and into a rear chin lock, eventually into a nice front face lock as well, where he keeps yanking and churning the whole time. Morocco breaks the hold with an inverted atomic drop and a pair of clotheslines. Morocco slings Steamboat over the top buckle into the post, slicing him wide open with a big gusher. Morocco bites the cut and then smiles in a really gross spot. He follows that by gouging the cut and pitching Steamboat to the floor. Morocco follows out and slingshots Steamer to the post and rams him into it a couple more times. Morocco slings Steamboat back inside and drills him with a thumb off the top rope before digging into the cut some more. Steamboat punches and chops into a comeback, but Morocco ends that with a hard clothesline. Morocco knocks Steamboat to the apron, where Fuji tries to get involved, but Steamboat kicks him off and grabs the cane. Back inside, both men fight over the cane and end up knocking the referee down. Dragon was able to kick Morocco down and grab the cane, which he uses to batter his enemy, and the referee wakes up and sees what's going on and DQs Steamboat. None of that mattered, though. Steamboat just keeps bringing the heat, breaking the cane over Morocco and jabbing the sharp shard into his forehead. Morocco finds a little energy and comes at Steamboat, but they roll to the floor with Steamboat and the bloodied Morocco now. Runs him into a post and barricade. Morocco's basically out of it and just keeps staggering into Steamboat, who's beating the shit out of him. I thought this started slow, but once it really got cooking. Steamboat's gash was nasty. I loved the focused attack by Morocco on it. Steamboat's comeback and wild post-match attack was really great, too, and the crowd has loved it all. This feud has been awesome and a really big one to establish Steamboat in the company. I went 3.5, Pete. What did you think of this one?
I went 3 stars, and I'm right with you, where I felt it was a little slow at the beginning, but really got cooking in the second half. I mean, you got to remember there was the big hanging angle, which established Steamboat, where Morocco hangs Ricky Steamboat. So actually, the psychology of what Steamboat's doing at the beginning makes sense, but it was just so. I mean, like Steamer, we see him with the Savate kick to the neck, which is great because you know what? It's kind of like a revenge spot for the hanging because the neck throat area is what's affecting your from a hanging. So I kind of like that. I like Steamer targeting the neck, which is, you know, the nice little revenge for the hanging. And then we see the snap air by Steamer, and I like that. Again, it's targeting the neck. I like Morocco going for the throat, which is, you know, a throwback to the hanging angle, but Steamboat cuts him off. I like Morocco's idea of trying to slow the pace down because he's a bigger guy. He shouldn't want to push the pace. I like that snapmare with the neck twist by Steamboat, again, focusing on the neck. So the psychology is fine there on the first half, but it was just so slow. And then we see this modified stretch clutch. And the first half was just too dang slow for my liking. And that front face lock ate up a chunk of time and really dragged it down for me a little bit. But once we get into the second half of Morocco, finally turns the tide, and he's after Steamer's throat at first, which, again, is great for one. It's revenge on the spot Steamer was doing earlier, and it follows a storyline of you hurt Steamboat with the hanging angle, so I like all that. But what really gets it going is once Steamer's busted open, and Morocco is after that cut, and the heat's well done by Morocco, and he's just after the cut. So everything Morocco's doing is textbook, heel work, just fantastic. I like Steamer's comebacks, and but only to get cut off by Morocco. And I love the stuff with the cane, and the post-match is just incredible. And, I mean, it was a really hot angle after the match. And what really I don't understand is this leads to kind of like you guys are going to cover them eventually, those dragon gi matches, right, where there are judo jacket matches, which seems so tame in comparison to this angle, which seems like it should be in a cage. Or I know they do some where all the wrestlers around the ring
lumberjack,
thank you, matches. But yeah, but most of them are the geese, and it just, for this heat of an angle, it just seems like that's kind of a lame payoff. But I still enjoyed the match. 3 stars.
I actually approached the beginning of the match differently. I gave this match 4 stars, and I loved it. And I'll tell you why. Because usually Morocco matches open with him like cheap-shotting somebody at the bell and him pretty much dominating the action. I enjoyed Steamboat taking it to Morocco very, excuse me, very aggressively, and kind of getting beat up a bit in the beginning, which is very un-Morocco like. And I thought it was kind of fresh. It was actually a fresh thing to look at for a Morocco match. And then it picked up, and then you had typical fare for probably the last like 8 minutes of the match. But I really dug it. I kind of enjoyed the different pacing in the beginning of the match, where Steamboat was really taking it to him, and Morocco was kind of punch drunk, which you really don't see in the beginning of a match. You usually see at the end of a match. So I was pleasantly surprised. I really enjoyed the pacing of it. I mean, I thought the brawling came out of nowhere because it felt like it was going at a very deliberate pace, and then suddenly it picked up. I did enjoy that. The ending was kind of weak, but I had a feeling we weren't going to get a definitive finish anyway. So I went into this match with that notion and just was looking forward to seeing how they'd get to that point. So I really enjoyed it. I loved the pacing and how unique it was from past matches Morocco was in, and that he let himself kind of get beat up a bit in the beginning as a babyface, almost like. So he kind of did reverse psychology there. It's very unique to see Steamboat in an aggressive style that you normally don't see in matches. He usually is very methodical and kind of gets his kicks and stuff in, but usually takes a decent beating early. This was different. He went right out of the gate and went right at Morocco. And obviously, there's a blood feud going on here. So the fact that Morocco was the one that got it started off hot was actually pretty awesome. So that's why I really enjoyed it. One of the best matches we've seen this year in the refresh, in my opinion. 4 stars. This next match is not 4 stars, but we do have some fun character development, as we always do. What do we got, JR?
We have our eighth match of the night is what we have. and that is between Terry Funk, who we talked about earlier, being interviewed by Gorilla Monsoon, taking on an odd random appearance by Mr. Wrestling number 2, John Francis Walker. Began wrestling training under Tony Morelli and Pat O'Connor, debuted in the ring in 1955 under the name Johnny Rubberman Walker. The Rubberman nickname was given to him by Houston promoter Paul Bosch due to Walker's flexibility. After a brief retirement from the ring in 64 to 67, Walker returned to the independent circuit in Florida in the late 60s under a mask as the Grappler. In 1972, Paul Jones and Leo Garibaldi approached Walker to return to the ring again, this time as Mr. Wrestling 2, paired with Tim Woods, the original Mr. Wrestling. Walker became an immediate hit with the Georgia crowds, and during his time in Georgia, Walker had the Georgia heavyweight title 10 times. Popular wrestler, then governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter. In May of 1984, Mr. Wrestling 2 began working for the WWF, a role he'd maintain until December 85. Pete, before we get to the match, give us your thoughts on Mr. Wrestling 2.
He's a guy I love. I love his shtick. I love his charisma. He's kind of like a Dusty Rhodes type character, but it was actually, I think, a better in-ring worker. He was great in World. Everyone, go to YouTube and watch him in Mass Superstars Angle from Georgia and the promos they do. It was fantastic stuff. His feud with him and Magnum as a tag team were really great in Mid-South. They had great matches with the Midnights, and then they feuded, too, and Magnum in a just great angle and a great build. It's definitely something that is must-watch type of stuff. He had good matches against Tully Blanchard in Mid-South and Mr. Wrestling 3 that I covered earlier. He's just a really fun worker, and it's amazing. I mean, he's probably like 50-something at this point we're watching him, and he can still go. He's not a super worker, but he's just a fun worker to watch. And again, he really was a good baby face. When he needed to be a heel, man, he could be a great heel too. Just a great, great, great worker.
You're gonna hate me after I talk about this match. So here we go. the odd random showing for Mr. Wrestling 2 against the Wild Terry Funk with Jimmy Hart. Funk stalls for a bit before the match, followed by Hart tackling Mel Phillips. Mr. Wrestling 2 makes a save, but Terry runs Mel off. Mr. 2's tights are a bit too baggy in the ass, I thought. He looked like he was carrying a load around his pants here. After more stalling, we finally get a lockup to get underway. That was followed by a crisscross, but 2 outwits him and stops and watches Funk run back and forth on his own. 2 keeps outsmarting Funk and keeping him rattled with his antics. Hart is talking the whole time as 2 lands a chop and a sunset flip for a 2 count. 2 dances around and mocks Funk, who gets more and more frustrated. Funk bails to regroup and comes back with a slam, but 2 dodges an elbow and batters Terry around some more. Hart would trip him up, and then he hits the ropes, but 2 chases him away and gets back in the ring. Funk met him there and landed a few shots to gain control, but 2 catches him in a small package off a slam and then mocks Funk some more. Funk regained control with some strikes and went for a pile driver, but 2 blocks it and dumped Funk over the top of the backdrop. 2 met Funk on the apron and punched and kicked and kneed away until Funk awkwardly dodged him and got a sunset flip for 2, which 2 rolls into a roll-up of his own for a near fall. The match spills outside where Funk runs him into the guardrail, and they keeps working him over with knees. Back inside, Funk grabs a sleeper that alternates with choking while Hart hops up on the apron and distracts the ref. Mr. Wrestling 2 makes a comeback and gets a near fall, but ends up sliding outside and chasing Hart around the ring. Funk takes advantage and kicks him in the head and then tries a suplex 2 back inside, but 2 collapses on it for a 2 count. 2 gets a suplex for another near fall and follows with knee lifts, but eats a Funk knee on a hard charge, and Funk covers and gets the win. Mr. Wrestling dodges the branding iron and grabs a chair to run Funk and Hart off. And I just thought it was a lot of nonsense here. I thought things picked up in the final moments. And I fully get the allure of the shtick for Mr. Wrestling 2, Pete. I get it. It's just not my jam at all. All the stalling and antics just bored me here. Maybe if I saw more of him as he became the character and built up the legend in Georgia, I'd appreciate it more. I just couldn't get into it. Again, things get cooking late, but it was still kind of awkward. There were a lot of busted spots along the way. Fine enough for the time, but nothing that holds up in my mind. I thought Funk deserved a better spot in the show, and I went with a paltry 1 star. Scott?
I went 4.5. No, I'm only kidding. Sorry, Pete. I went 1.5 here. It was fine. It's always Funk. Funk's entertaining. The Mel Phillips stuff is always good. Most press he ever got in his life, or at least good press. It wouldn't get much better after. Wouldn't get much better after this. I could see the previous 2 matches going long. This one, Our final total was 1354. I mean, that this was thoroughly unnecessary to go 1354. I think this is more to pump Funk up for the future feud with Hogan coming up. And that was pretty much that. Mr. Wrestling 2 was just here to put him over. I don't think we didn't need 14 minutes of being put over, but that's pretty much what it came down to. I don't not much more to say here. Again, I gave it a star and a half. Pete.
Now, to be the voice of reason, I enjoyed this match, and I gave it 3 stars, and these guys would have sold out the Omni in Atlanta if this was in Georgia. I felt Mr. Wrestling 2 got a nice reaction from New York, from someone who they've never really, I doubt they've seen very much. I found it rather funny that a guy in a white hood was saving the black man from from a cowboy. Because you think that would be asked, they think that would be backwards. Definitely in the South it would have been backwards. So I don't know who Phillips was most terrified of, the white hood man or the cowboy. But still.
If he had his shoes off, he would have been all into it, though.
Exactly. I thought the shtick worked. I thought it was a lot of fun early on. I always enjoy seeing the C Wrestling 2 shucking and jiving. I enjoy all that stuff. It was a lot of back and forth early, and we actually get more of a modern feel type of thing to it, where there's a lot more back and forth as opposed to seeing how like Morocco and Steamboat was work, where you have like long heat and long shine segments. This is a lot of back and forth action, more modern-esque in a way. I liked, we see Funk pull out the Flair ref spot, which to me always gets over and always pops the crowd. And here we see Funk playing Flair, and this ref is no Tommy Young, but it still gets over. I thought Funk was incredible in some of these spots here. And overall, I just enjoyed it. It was a lot of shtick. A lot of different. It was just. I felt I liked it more because it was totally different than anything else on the card, where they were working more of like a shtick and wink wink and I felt it was a good change of pace. I think it would have worked better on a different structured card than it did here.
Any particular Mr. Wrestling 2 matches you would tout as like, you know, for someone that wants to learn about him or, you know, see more of what he was about, that you would say are the really more engaging ones?
You know, he's a guy who doesn't have a ton of footage out there, honestly. But I would go check him and Magnum TA either against each other or him and Magnum TA against the Midnight Express. Just really great, great tag match. I mean, there's one from Houston where the Midnights, it was a disqualification, but you see Bobby Eaton just bumping all over for Mr. Wrestling's $2 million knee lift. Another one I think I must see is like the Loser Leave Town from Mid-South, where it was Wrestling 2 and JYD against it was the with the big angle with Duggan in the gorilla suit, and it was TV versus DiBiase and Matt Bourne, and it's uploaded on the WWE Network right now on one of the shows that they uploaded from the Mid-South shows. I don't have the date in front of me, but it's an incredible angle. And often imitated, but never really duplicated. I mean, you don't see it coming until, I mean, after the fact, now everyone knows, kind of a lot of people know the history of it, so you'll see it coming. But when you first saw it as a young kid, you didn't see it coming. It was just a great angle and a great match.
All right, there you go. A lot of insight in Mr. Wrestling 2 for those like me, uneducated. Admittedly uneducated. I knew I'd be well.
I just knew he was in a car. It was in a plane crash. That's really all I knew about Mr. Wrestling 2, really, to this point, that he was in. Right? He was in the Flair plane, right, Pete?
I'm not quite sure about that one. It's so hard to remember, honestly, because there's the two big ones. I'm not sure.
But yeah, there was the Flair one, and there was the one that had Gary Hart.
Yeah. I just can't remember all the names. I know he wasn't with the Flair one, so if it was, he was in when the – it was Mr. Tim Woods was in the Flair one.
Yes, I think the Gary Hart one, I'm actually going to check now. I think the Gary Hart one was, let me see, later career, death, no, plane. Did they mention the plane crash? I thought they did. I'm trying to think. I think Buddy, oh, here it is. February 20th, 1975, Hart and wrestlers Austin Idol and Bobby Shane were passengers on a Cessna 182 flown by wrestler Buddy Colt, which crashed into Tampa Bay, and Bobby Shane died. Obviously, Austin Idol didn't, because he ended up having a pretty good career in Memphis. So, yeah, Tim Woods was in the Flair plane.
Yeah, Woods was in the Flair when Johnny Walker wasn't in any of them. So,
no. Maybe there was Johnny. Well, maybe there was Johnny Walker on the plane, but
yeah,
we don't know.
But Chris Zellner always pushes for him for the Hall of Fame in the Observer. Always puts up his piece every year. And so, if you want to go, you guys check, read that, and you get a really good history piece on Mr. Wrestling too.
Very nice, very nice. But we have no mass wrestlers in our main event. We got a pretty Haas six-man tag, JR. Who do we got here? We got big Haases everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Haas is left and right for this fiasco of a main event here. And our main event is Big John Studd, King Kong Bundy, and Bobby Heenan battling Andre the Giant, Hillbilly Jim, and Lou Albano. I guess the triple colossal jostle. I don't know. Keep evolving this feud month after month, which has been fun. Hillbilly's big push continues, again, closing out the show alongside Andre, his teammate yet again. We also have Albano stepping in there, too, hot off his big pie-eating contest win. Team Andre gets a massive pop, as you'd expect. The feud has been a ton of fun. Andre and Studd open things up with Andre gaining control and laying in some hard shots before tagging in Jim. Jim lays in some headbutts and almost slams Studd, but Studd grabs the ropes to block it. Bundy tags in and lays the wood, but Hillbilly dodges an elbow, and Bundy maintains control and grabs a near fall before clubbing away. Hillbilly ducks a strike and tags in Andre, leading to a great stare down with Bundy. Andre just grabs him by the throat and chokes him until Bundy lands a shot to the healing sternum. Bundy punches away at Andre, grabs a front face lock as Jesse says Andre has not been the same since that chest injury. Bundy shoves Andre into the corner and catches shots from everyone while he's there. Studd tags in, but Andre grabs him in a bear hug. Studd reaches up and tags in Bundy, who hammers Andre from behind and goes back to work on a front face lock and then to a bear hug. Andre punches his way free, but Bundy tags in Studd, who comes in and fires away at the sternum. Andre chops Studd away and tags in Hillbilly, who lays in some clubbing blows. Studd catches Hillbilly with some elbows and slams him into the corner. Bundy comes in and kicks away and then goes to a reverse chin lock. Bundy tags in Heenan, who punches away while Jim is on the ground. Jim headbutts Heenan away and tags in Andre, but Bobby backs off and tags Studd. Andre yanks Heenan into the ring, and the ref allows it. Andre drags Bobby to the corner and tags in Lou, who comes in and lands a bunch of punches to pops. Bobby backs off, and Heenan dares him to come at him. Bobby tries it, but Albano no-sells the punch and hammers away before slinging Bobby into the corner. Heenan bails outside and tags Bundy, but the referee forces Bobby back in, leading to Gorilla just flipping out about the referee forcing Bobby to face Andre, saying there's no contact rule and Bobby should be permitted to tag out without touching. Bobby touches Andre and then runs to the corner and tags Studd, who comes in and punches away. Andre rams Studd and Bundy into each other and then buries them in the corner. Bobby makes a save, but he gets piled up, and Albano and Hibbley help ram Andre into all three of them, which the crowd loved. Studd and Bundy get whipped into each other, and everyone starts brawling until Albano slings Heenan into an Andre big boot for the win. Jesse and Gorilla both bitch at the referee for losing control. They say Bobby wasn't the legal man. Team Andre celebrates to a pop. I thought this was fun in spots, but kind of messy and not as high energy as the past jostles. Bobby was really fun, but all the referee shit was confusing and weird, and Gorilla just trashing him and defending Bobby felt off. The feud has been a lot of fun, but I think it's losing steam. Like, they probably just should just get a break or a blow-off here sooner than later. I'm kind of done with the incarnations of this one. Hillbilly wasn't as good here as he was last month either. Fine main event, but it felt really rinse-repeat for the most part after watching these all in order. It didn't feel like that much different, even though we had Bobby and Albano in there. I went 2 stars on this, Pete.
I went a star, but I did like the dynamic, and at least the ending made everyone happy because, I mean, we had Funk go over, who was a heel. We had technically Morocco. They go to a no finish there, so all the big matches, and then the Dream Team retained, so there was a lot of heels going over here, so they did, for sure, at least they made the crowd happy by the faces going over. But yeah, I thought it was just a kind of a mess at times, and then sloppy, and yeah, it got confusing, but yeah, definitely nothing you need to see.
What do you think, Scott?
I averaged you both out. I went 1.5 stars. Yeah, I agree with you, JR. The sizzle's off this steak. It's starting to reach the end of the line here. Somebody's got to win something. Andre needs to just beat somebody, you know, conclusively. The problem is you're not going to do it to Bundy because of what's coming up with him. Studd, I don't know, and, you know, pinning Bobby does nothing. But the crowd was pretty nuclear. Got to give the crowd credit. They were pumped up. I mean, they were handed the same pile of shit we were. They were really pumped and into it. Yeah, the Gorilla complained. That was odd. There was so don't know if they were just like fed up by the end of the night or whatever, but they were just, both him and Gorilla were just like, they were just done. They were just done with this whole night.
I mean, they're known for telling it like it is, especially in these house shows. I think they were just really like, I don't know. I think they were just making it realistic and calling out the referee for sucking. I mean, that's what it seemed like to me.
Yeah, yeah. I just felt like they just seemed so exasperated. Like, can this thing end? It's like really funny, but I gave it a star and a half. I mean, it's serving its purpose, I guess. But I agree with you, JR. I think we need an ending here soon, before these. And you know, you never want Andre to be the minute Andre becomes stale, you're in a lot of trouble. That means you're burning him out. So you need something happening soon. You need something happening soon. All right, so there we go. And Pete, you, the first time you're experiencing this, because it's time for the awards.
All right, awards. Let's go with our match of the night. Mine, very easily, was Steamboat Morocco. Pete?
Yeah, there's no doubt.
Yeah, no Steamboat doubt. Morocco. Yeah, I'm with you guys on that one.
All right. Our Drizzler, which we're going to rename the Cousin Junior Award.
Yes, we are. Well, it was that one.
Yes, I'm going with Junior and Herc. Everyone agree?
Yes. Yeah, oh, there's
agreed.
No doubt.
Yeah, agreed.
It's a Cousin Junior.
Let's mark this down here.
Okay.
All right. Our MVP of the night, I went with Ricky Steamboat. I thought he was the best wrestler on this evening. I thought he took a superb ass kicking. I thought his blade job was great, and I loved his post-match attack. Scott?
I agree 100%. Again, I just love the way he worked that match. Very different than any match he's usually in, particularly with Morocco. So I concur with Steamboat. Pete?
Yeah, I would say Steamboat, but I'm going to go with Morocco just for a change of pace. I really liked his heat segment. I think that heat segment, yeah, and it helped that you have a world-class seller in Steamboat fighting underneath it. But, yeah, I thought the psychology of the heat segment of that match was what really made it stand out.
Mm.
All right, our Gator Wolf Award for the worst worker of the night. I thought it was very easily Cousin Junior. It was fucking terrible. Pete?
Yeah, we'll go Cousin Junior. He deserves all the negative accolades you can possibly get.
Scott?
Yes, I agree. Oh, there's no doubt. He's a slug.
Best moment, I went with Steamboat's post-match attack in Morocco.
I like Hercules' chin lock. No.
Which one?
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I think, Steamboat was just top-notch the whole night, so I agree.
Pete?
That's a tough one. I'm going to go with my best moment. Yeah, I'll go with Steamboat. The Steamboat, yeah. I'll go with Steamboat's being on top.
All right, and our Junior Mr. Universe Award for the most roided-up guy on the show, I thought it was Hercules in a walk.
Oh, there's no doubt, this one. Yeah. No, on this one, there's no doubt. Nobody's as big on this evening.
Pete?
Yeah, and I'm going to go back. I'm going to go with Jesse Ventura. It was a cool moment to see him wrestle out of retirement. So I'll go with him as the best moment? Yeah.
Okay.
And, yeah, definitely Hercules was definitely the most roided. Yep, for sure.
Yeah, he was jacked. Okay. Overall grade out of 10, I went with a 3 out of 5, which... that is pretty much the lowest grade I've gone with. I thought this is the worst show we've watched since
we started
this
reboot. You mean
3.5 out of 10, I should say.
Oh, 3.5. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I thought it was the worst show we've watched since we started. Scott, there wasn't much here. There was one really good match, and in my mind, nothing else going on. Even only having Gorilla alone for the first four matches, that hurt. Like, you get the little bump for the historical spider stuff. But other than that, in Morocco Steamboat, I just didn't see much here. What do you have?
Well, let's see. I gave... The worst show we've watched in 1985 for me was the last one, the Wrestling Classic. So the question I have to ask myself is, was this show worse than the Wrestling Classic? And it's not, but not by much. I'm also going to give it 3.5. Morocco Steamboat saves it from probably being lower than the Wrestling Classic. So the rest of the show is really bad. And of course, the screw job thing is confusing. The commentary seemed off at times tonight. So I'm going to say 3.5, which will be my second worst grade of the year, because I still think the Wrestling Classic's the worst show of the year. Pete, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm going to go 4.5. I liked it a little better because I enjoyed the Funk Wrestling 2 match more than you guys, and I also enjoyed the tag match a little bit more than you guys. But you guys enjoyed Steamer Morocco a little bit more than I did. But yeah, about 4.5. 4.5. We'll go 4. Go 4.
All right, there you go. So another one in the book, Scott. We only have one more show here in 1985. Mm-hmm. We're done with our first calendar year. We'll be back next Tuesday night, next week, a little bit different. We're going to have our Freebird partner, Kelly Nelson, back in the house. Of course, Pete's former co-Titan. I like how Pete, I like how we've low-key kept the Titans alive with this show. We're talking 85. We've had Parv. We've had you. We've had Kelly. You know, it's a, we're keeping the magic going.
Yeah, I mean, he'll be fresh off his bachelor party, which was a couple days ago.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I'll have to talk, catch up with him about that on the show. So, Pete, anything you want to plug before we wrap up?
Oh, yeah, just follow me on Twitter at Titans O Wrestling. Follow here. Listen to Space City and NWA On Demand podcast over on Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation. Yeah. And you know, of course, follow me on This Week in Wrestling, Indies and International with my buddy Tim. We just had Devin Hales on, and we talked some NXT along with some Rev Pro and the normal stuff we cover. So check them out if you haven't. If you have, keep on checking them out, and appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
There you go. All right, Scott. So, like I said, we'll be back next Tuesday. This Wednesday, Clotheslines and Headlines with our buddy Brandon Howard, me, Steve, and Nate will be in the house breaking down WrestleMania and looking at, I guess, starting to look at Payback and the Superstar Shakeup and everything going on tonight on Raw and SmackDown tomorrow night. Next week, I'm sure you'll be back in main event, but we'll talk about that next Tuesday. Check out us all our social media, facebook.com/place2bnation, Twitter, place2bnation. Of course, each and every day now, we're doing a question of the day. And if you get your answer in there, every Monday, we're going to run a roundup on placenation.com so you can see your answer on the website as well. Plenty to check out. Our index is fully up to date. So if you missed anything, if you're new to the site, visit the index page on place2bnation. You can catch up on each and every piece that's out there. That we've ever posted, both audio and written, all archived for you in one easy spot. Yes. So, for our buddy Pete and for Scott, I'm Justin. We're out. We'll talk to you next Tuesday. Everyone have a great week. Scott, you can take your spider mask off now.
Woo! Damn it, I want more money.